this morning and is believed to have died last night.
But if you run, can you ever escape the truth?
I've seen dead bodies before. I know what I saw.
The Courier.
If she didn't, someone else did.
Begins this Friday at 2:15 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's 6 o'clock on Wednesday the 3rd of June. This is Today with Anna Foster and Amol Raj.
Good morning. The headlines today. The Home Secretary has condemned what she called unacceptable scenes in Southampton, where a protest over the murder of student Henry Novak ended with attacks on police. And the United States and Iran have again exchanged missile fire in the Gulf, putting their fragile ceasefire under further strain.
Also on the programme today, should the US tech giant Palantir have their £330 million NHS contract terminated? We'll hear from the MP arguing it should and speak to Palantir's UK boss. The ancient microbe still alive inside a 5,000-year-old frozen mummy, Ötzi the Iceman, and what they tell us about science today. And the animals that could replace the likes of Winston Churchill and Jane Austen on our banknotes. Well, that obviously was the bottlenose dolphin, the hedgehog and the bumblebee. They're all on the shortlist. We're going to tell you about the others and why they've been chosen. But first, the BBC News is read this morning by Lisa Costello.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has condemned disorder at a protest in Southampton about the police handling of the murder of Henry Novak, describing the scenes as completely unacceptable. The student was handcuffed and arrested after he was fatally stabbed last December because his killer, Vikram Digwa, had lied to police that he'd been racially attacked. Ms. Mahmood said there could be no justification for hijacking the tragedy to fuel violence and disorder. Our correspondent Tim Muffett reports.
About 200 to 300 people gathered outside Southampton Police Station. They heard speeches by figures including the far-right activist Tommy Robinson, whose real name is Stephen Yaxley Lennon. The crowds chanted, "Justice for Henry." The crowd then moved away, about a mile and a half into the suburbs and close to the family home of Vikram Digwa, the killer of Henry Novak. Bins, some bricks and an e-scooter were thrown at police. While officers with riot shields and batons attempted to hold a line along a street. Posting on social media, the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, condemned those involved in the disturbances. She said there could be no justification for hijacking the tragedy of Henry Novak's death to stir up violence and disorder.
The National Police Chiefs Council is re-examining anti-racism commitments, which suggested officers should treat ethnic minorities differently in order to ensure equality of outcomes. It said it was listening to concerns raised by MPs. A source close to the Home Secretary said the wording in the document was clumsy and it was right to review it. The US military says it has carried out self-defense strikes on Iran, shooting down ballistic missiles and drones fired at ships and at Gulf allies. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard said it had only been responding to a strike on its territory. The incidents highlight the fragile nature of the current ceasefire, as our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
US Central Command said two Iranian missiles fired towards Kuwait fell short or broke apart in flight, while three missiles launched at Bahrain were intercepted by American and Bahraini air defense systems. The US military also said its forces carried out self-defense strikes against an Iranian military ground control station on Keshma Island in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran says the target was a communications tower south of the island and has cited that attack as the reason for its retaliation. Earlier, US forces fired on an oil tanker attempting to sail towards Iran's oil terminal at Karg Island. Officials said the Botswana-flagged vessel was disabled by a missile strike on its engine room after ignoring repeated warnings to alter course.
Microsoft says it's developed a quantum computer chip which is 1,000 times more reliable than the previous version. The tech giant says the new chip, the Majorana 2, takes it a step closer to building a commercially viable quantum machine that could solve some of the world's biggest challenges. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman reports.
The computing power in a quantum machine comes from tiny, delicate units called qubits. They operate in a very fragile state and usually last just a few milliseconds. But Microsoft claims the qubits on its new Majorana 2 chip can survive for 20 seconds, giving them a lot more time to process complex calculations. This has been made possible by substituting aluminium on the chip for lead. The aim is that one day quantum computers will help solve big problems such as how to get rid of microplastics and come up with formulas for new fertilisers to help farmers grow more food.
A committee of MPs wants the government to end its NHS data contract in England with the tech giant Palantir. The company has deep links in US defence and security, and the Science, Innovation and Technology Committee has said that there's a clear mismatch with UK values. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
NHS England awarded Palantir the seven-year data contract, which includes helping the management of hospital waiting lists, in 2023. But there's a break clause early next year, which the Commons Committee proposes the government uses to appoint a company it describes as more compatible with UK values. It says the reliance on a small number of US-based providers poses a clear vulnerability. Palantir said its platform had provided benefits for patients. The government said it was speeding up diagnoses and treatment.
Russia says its air defences have been responding to a Ukrainian drone attack on the area around St. Petersburg and that 30 have been shot down. Ukrainian sources say an oil refinery was hit, but that's not been confirmed. MPs and charities are urging the technology giant Meta to protect users after a BBC investigation found that women who've had a miscarriage were unable to stop baby-related ads appearing in their social media feeds. Meta says it's trying to improve its systems. Hayley Compton reports.
Some mothers who've had a miscarriage or stillbirth say they've been bombarded with maternity-related adverts on Facebook and Instagram, which they have found upsetting and re-traumatising. Many told the BBC that they struggled to stop the ads appearing in their feeds, despite changing their preferences. Meta, which runs the two platforms, has admitted that its systems aren't perfect, but says it's continuing to improve how ads are delivered. The government's new maternity advisor, the MP Michelle Welsh, is calling on Meta to make it easier to stop unwanted adverts.
The Bank of England is asking the public to choose which animals and birds should appear on the next generation of banknotes. From today, people have a month to select from a short list as wildlife replaces the historical figures that have featured on notes for more than half a century.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 7 minutes past six now. Let's see what the weather has got in store for us today with Simon King. Morning, Simon.
Hi, hello, Anna. Good morning. Well, low pressure is moving in for today and tomorrow. That's going to make it really quite blustery across many areas. It's going to feel pretty fresh as well, with some rain, some showers in the forecast. So for southwest England, Wales, the West Midlands, northwest England, we're going to start to see some rain moving its way into West Wales over the next few hours. And that's going to spread quickly eastward to all areas through this morning. The rain will eventually clear away, but showers follow. And some of these could be heavy, particularly in parts of northwest England. Some sunny spells, but those will be rather limited. And as I said, turning pretty windy with highs of 16 to 18 degrees. In southeast England, the East Midlands, eastern England and northeast England, after a dry start, we'll see some rain moving its way in, I think, by mid-morning. Most of that will clear eastward by early afternoon, and there'll be some sunny spells, but again, some showers, which could be heavy, possibly thundery in the north of England. It's quite breezy, temperatures of 17 to 20 Celsius. Now, for Northern Ireland, already the rain is starting to move its way in, and that's going to sound quite heavy through this morning for a time. It will move away to the northeast into southwestern areas of Scotland, and then eventually clearing from there as well. But again, there'll be some frequent showers following, the risk of some thunderstorms, pretty windy, highs of 15 to 17 degrees. And then for northern and eastern Scotland, after a dry start, that rain moves in by mid-morning, turning quite heavy, possibly thundery, clearing away, but again, showers follow with highs of 14 to 16 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. It is 9 minutes past six. Let's take you through some of the front pages this morning. And the Henry Novak case is on the front pages of all the morning papers. Never again reads the main headline in The Sun. Beneath a photo of Mr. Novak being handcuffed as he lies on the ground. The Daily Mirror uses the same image and asks, why didn't they listen? The Times says police chiefs will review what it calls controversial anti-racism guidance, and its editorial calls for an end to attempts at social engineering.
Writing in the Daily Telegraph this morning, the Reform UK leader Nigel Farage says an accusation of a racial slur was taken more seriously than an act of murder. He adds that an anti-white prejudice has been allowed to fester. The Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch writes in the Daily Mail that the incident needs to be seen as a Stephen Lawrence moment in the way that race allegations can affect policing. She says we need to stop the idea that racism is something that happens only to ethnic minorities perpetrated by white people.
The Daily Express claims the killing has caused division in the right wing of British politics, highlighting criticism by Ms. Badenoch of comments made by Nigel Farage. The Daily Star calls it the arrest that outraged a nation.
Appeals for calm as murder case raises fears of racial tension is the headline in The Guardian. The front of the iPaper features a photo of hundreds of protesters outside Southampton police station. It says the plea for calm from Henry Novak's family has been ignored.
Elsewhere, The Telegraph reports that more senior members of the government use the disappearing messages function, on WhatsApp. It says not only the Prime Minister, but the Chancellor and the Foreign Secretary all do it. Downing Street says Sir Keir fully complied with demands to publish material.
And the Financial Times this morning reports that the US is considering deploying nuclear capabilities to more NATO European states. It has apparently indicated that a bomber capable of carrying nuclear payloads could be stationed in more countries to reassure members that the US remains committed to the alliance.
That brings us to 11 minutes past six. Well, protesters clashed with police last night in Southampton, close to where Henry Novak was stabbed to death. They were chanting, as you may have heard there, Henry, Henry, and I can't breathe, as demonstrations ended with those attacks on police. The Home Secretary has condemned the scenes overnight as completely unacceptable. Let's speak to BBC South Today's Peter Cook, who was at the scene. Peter, morning. Just tell us what you saw when you were there over the night and what's going on now.
Good morning, Amal. Well, I spent several hours at both locations last night. It all started just after 5 o'clock as people started gathering outside Southampton police station, a number of protesters. Those numbers slowly built to around 250 to 300. They were there to see a number of people making speeches, including the far-right figure Tommy Robinson and also activist Lawrence Fox. Now, the protest there was very peaceful. The people stayed for around an hour or so before they slowly made their way through the city on foot, followed by a number of police officers about a mile and a half to 2 miles outside of the city into the suburbs. As you mentioned, into an area very close to where Henry Novak lost his life. And that area in the St. Denis area was also quite close to the scene of the family home of Vikram Digwa, the man who was jailed on Monday for 21 years for stabbing Henry Novak. Another large crowd, probably at its peak around 250 to 300 a number, were, as you've heard in that audio, chanting, and also then began throwing missiles at the police, which included bins, e-scooters, bricks and bottles. It was an ugly scene and a very tense atmosphere. At the time, the police responded by blocking off both ends of the street and trying to force the protesters away from that property. But those scenes remained for some hours before finally those protesters started to disperse.
And just then, we're going to have lots more, obviously, on this throughout the programme, Peter. But just for those who don't know Southampton as a city well, can you just tell us a little bit about the area that Henry Novak lived in and where he was murdered?
Yeah, the area we lived in is a relatively affluent area in the suburbs, quite close to one of the main arterial roads that come into the city. And ultimately, you know, the protesters who went there last night clearly knew where they were going. Many of them were streaming live on social media. They seemed to all know the address. The police obviously clearly seemed to anticipate the potential trouble as they had followed them out of the city, and they clearly, by some of the people who'd been protesting and live streaming, had indicated what they were planning to do. So a number of residents I witnessed came out fairly horrified and shocked to see what they were seeing, and you know, clearly Southampton's slowly stirring this morning. People are waking up to seeing very ugly images of their city. We're awaiting potential updates from Hampshire Police. We didn't see any police officers who were injured. It was lucky, to be honest, because one, that e-scooter particularly nearly fell on the head of a female police officer. And we're also waiting for any updates if any arrests were made. I didn't see any arrests being made. A number of the protesters were injured during those clashes.
Okay, Peter Cook from BBC South today. Thank you very much indeed.
14 minutes past six now. The US has launched more what it calls self-defence strikes on Iran overnight. In response, Tehran fired again towards its Gulf neighbours. Our North America correspondent Peter Bowes told me how this all fits with the daily talk of a long-lasting ceasefire.
This is the latest series of strikes on Iran by US force, which US Central Command said was in self-defence, intercepting ballistic missiles and drones that it said were fired at ships and targets in Kuwait and Bahrain. They didn't reach their targets. The US military described its intervention as successful. It said its forces also carried out and again self-defense strikes against an Iranian military ground control station at Keshma, the largest island on the Strait of Hormuz, a key military base. Iranian state media said its attacks were in response to a US strike on a communications tower south of Keshma, and earlier and separately, US forces fired on a Botswana-flagged oil tanker which was attempting to sail towards Iran's oil terminal at Karg Island. And officials said it was disabled by another missile strike on its engine room after ignoring repeated warnings to alter course.
And Peter, this, I mean, it's not even the first time this week that we've had this conversation about new, fresh attacks in the area while a ceasefire is supposed to be in place, while talks towards a more durable ceasefire are still happening. What more has been said about that?
Well, yes, and it does make it look as if this ceasefire is increasingly fragile. Peace talks, as you say, still appear to be stalled, but they're not over. And I think the rhetoric is certainly heating up from Iran. They're talking in terms of disrupting the security of the Strait of Hormuz would carry a heavy price for the aggressive US military, and the US has said that its forces remain vigilant, prepared to respond to what it described as unwarranted Iranian aggression. So that is the talk all the time around this. Donald Trump in Washington is saying that the negotiations have been going on continuously. Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, has again repeated that he and the administration believe that a deal is within reach. In fact, he implied that progress was being made since he said that Iran had now agreed to negotiate aspects of their nuclear program.
Peter Bowes, thank you.
17 minutes past six, amid the endless talk about how to exert democratic control over technology giants, the Competition and Markets Authority has just announced that online publishers will be able to opt out of their content being used to power AI features in Google Search. That search function, of course, massively boosted at Google's recent I.O. developer conference. Sean Farrington has more on that and the rest of the business news. Good morning, Sean.
Yeah, morning, I'm on the habit. And lots to talk about with SpaceX as well this morning, grabbing a fair few headlines. The latest big company that is attempting, I say big, that's about the biggest understatement I've ever made at this time of the morning, trying to get investors around the world to get their money involved with them. I've got Will Walker Arnott with me this morning, who is from Raymond James. Will, good morning to you. Just lay out what's a little bit different about this SpaceX attempt, Elon Musk's company. Is it a space company? Is it an artificial intelligence company? And how he wants to try and raise that money and get investors around the world involved.
Morning, Sean. Yeah, well, where do we start with Elon Musk? I mean, nothing's really conventional with him. What is unconventional about SpaceX? Well, let's start with actually the retail offering. About 30% of the shares in the IPO are going to be available to retail investors, both in the US and also the UK. This is unusual because normally during IPOs, it's the big institutions which gets the allocation. But I think this is a reflection actually of the importance of the retail investor in driving markets over the last 5 years since COVID. The other thing which is slightly unconventional is, I suppose, the free floats, the amount of shares which are going to be available to investors, which is very, very small, less than 5%. So a lot of power is still going to be controlled by Elon Musk, who's going to have 85% of the voting shares.
And there'll be plenty more conversations to be had about all of this, Will, as it sort of progresses. But there have been some concerns amongst some notable analysts making a fair few headlines that actually the potential valuation of SpaceX might be nowhere near what some of the headlines are grabbing. So $1.8 trillion is what some are talking about the valuation being when it lists on the stock market. But investor analysts like Morningstar saying it could be worth half that, actually. And just a reminder amongst the hype that it's not a guarantee that something goes up. You know, stock prices can go down as well.
Yeah, I mean, Morningstar worth listening to because unlike a lot of the other financial analysts, they don't have any skin in the game. They're not actually involved in the IPO process, so they're independent in that manner. And, you know, you've got to look at the valuation. It's 100 times revenues, which is extraordinary, really. The company is actually posting a loss of $4.3 billion in the last accounts. And so there are question marks over the valuation. There are also question marks over the businesses which have been folded into SpaceX. And that would include things like XAI and X, which are not profitable at all. So often when you get to this raft of IPOs, it can be seen as peak of the market stuff. So I think people just need to be vigilant of that.
Will, good to talk to you this morning. Will Walker-Arnott from Raymond James. Let's talk more about that story. Amol was telling us had just broken in the last 15 minutes, 20 minutes or so, that the Competition and Markets Authority has said that online publishers will be able to opt out of their content being used to power those AI features that come up in Google search. So the kind of things you see at the top of those search results, the AI overviews. I've got Will Hayter with me, who's Executive Director for Digital Markets at the Competition and Markets Authority. Will, good morning. Just explain what it is you're announcing this morning. What changes for publishers?
Good morning. Thank you. News organisations and other content businesses have found that since Google added AI reviews to the top of its search results, fewer people are clicking through to their sites. Now, that really matters because it means fewer pairs of eyes on their sites and less money from advertising, which in turn could mean less high-quality content for people to read. So today, the requirement we're introducing, which is the first of its kind anywhere in the world, gives businesses the right to opt out of Google features like AI overviews. That puts businesses in a better position to negotiate with Google for the use of their content. And Google will also need to show where the information in AI overviews comes from so people can trust what they're reading and can click through more easily.
So users will see a different result, not just the publishers whose information is being used, but users will see it change as well. How quickly do you expect all this to be put into place?
So there's a compliance period for Google, which has a staging post at 6 months and then completes at 9 months. But actually, you may have seen that Google has just announced that it will actually start testing a new control from today, which is the way it's planning to comply with the requirement, which is really good news. It means that the requirement will actually start to take effect really quite soon.
Have you found previously, Will, that Google were acting inappropriately with how they were using the publisher's information and the new AI technologies?
So it's not really a question of acting inappropriately. There's a negotiation that takes place between content providers and Google. And what we want to see in that process is a fair exchange of value between platforms like Google and content businesses. In Google's case, that fair exchange has really been prevented by the fact that publishers haven't been able to opt their content out of AI search features without losing access to search traffic.
So companies like Google, are they sort of, you know, pushing the limits of this regulation as far as they can go? Even if it's not necessarily fair for their customers, they're waiting for the regulator to act. Is that how you see this dynamic at the moment?
We found Google to have this position of what's called strategic market status, which reflects the powerful position that it has in search. And there's, as I said, this is a negotiation that happens between Google and publishers. And we're changing that from today with the new control, which we expect will significantly improve content businesses' ability to negotiate with Google.
Why should there be an opt-out rather than an opt-in? Like, why should the default be that Google gets, you know, access and can use this, the work of publishers around the world, many here in the UK?
Well, this goes to the history of the development of search. So publishers traditionally have wanted to be part of search because that's an important part of how traffic is driven to their sites. What we're seeing is that the introduction of AI overviews changes that, changes the nature of the negotiation between Google and publishers. And we think it's important if you're put yourself in the place of a major news publisher or indeed the BBC perhaps even, you may still want to appear in the standard search results, but then choose not to be in AI overviews or AI mode. Perhaps.
How will you monitor that a publisher's position in those search results won't be diminished if they're opting out of being in the AI results? How do you know that?
So there's an important principle point in the...
It seems at a crucial point there, we've lost Will Hayter, who's the Executive Director for Digital Markets at the Competition Markets Authority. A few more questions to be asked, but no doubt we'll get round to those one day. Let's talk about what changes might be kicking in with the FTSE 100, the FTSE 250. So these lists on the stock market of our biggest 100 companies, then the next 250 companies. We get a change every few months as company sizes move between them. And Sherry Kutu joins us now, who's serial entrepreneur, angel investor of more than 70 tech companies, former non-executive for the London Stock Exchange as well. Keeps an eye on these things. Sherry, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. They do tell us a little bit about, well, what investors are into at this moment in time, which companies, which industries are doing sort of better than others. And it's interesting to see that, you know, the tech services provider, Computer Centre, many might not have heard of it before, looks like it may well be entering the FTSE 100, the list of our biggest companies. What does it sort of tell you about a business when they make these moves into, they get promotion into the top tier?
What it means, well, it's partly symbolic and partly very practical. So promotion to the FTSE 100 means that a company gets bought automatically by every tracker fund and passive ETF that's benchmarked to the index, be it 100 or 250. And there's roughly £20 trillion worth of them globally. That drives up demand for the shares, it lowers their borrowing costs, and it raises the company's profile with institutional investors. And demotion from the 100 to the 250 works in reverse, so which will force those index funds to sell those shares, which gives them slightly reduced visibility and maybe a negative signal to the market about the company's trajectory.
And overall, Sherry, what sort of trends do you sort of see in the movements of companies at the moment, those that are generally getting bigger and maybe those that are heading in the opposite direction, you know, dropping out of some of these lists?
Well, you mentioned Computer Centre, which, again, not that many people know about it, but it's been on the stock market since 1998. Its value has increased by 44% in the past year. If you look at that and you look at some of the other joiners to the 100, it looks like financial services are in great health, and it also looks like the tech and the B2B IT services are doing well, which is good. It's not a surprise because those businesses are often global. And with Computer Centre, they announced a number of the large hyperscalers who were buying their stuff. So they should be really pleased. And as long as those companies that are buying their services keep on growing, it'll be good news for them, and it'll be good news for us as well.
And interestingly, keeping a close eye on Rightmove, the property website, of course, the property developer, Berkeley Group, as well. They could be dropping into the FTSE 250. Is that telling us something about the housing industry, the building sector in the UK at the moment?
I wouldn't say so. I think it says more about the tech companies and the financial services that are growing in value on a global basis. These are globally consequential companies. And again, you need to remember the index is you can never have more than 100 of them in the FTSE 100. So if some sector is growing, like the tech giants, then by its very nature, some other companies will fall out. So I think it says more, you know, who is being promoted says more about the demand, supply and the demand for those services. If it's a global company and the stock markets around the world are growing, then that's going to increase the demand for tech. And again, as I said, you've got the hyperscalers that are buying a lot of computer center goods and services at the moment, which is exciting.
We have to wrap it there. Sherry Kutu there, serial entrepreneur, angel investor. We've just got a response in from Google as well in that news that publishers will be able to opt out of their stuff being used in Google's AI services. So Google saying that Google's actively listening to feedback from publishers and creators and engaging with regulators like the one we heard from briefly a little before, the Competition and Markets Authority, who's made this announcement this morning.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? More to come on that, I'm sure. Thank you, Sean. It's 29 minutes past six. Now it's time for the sport. Mike Williams is here. Hello.
Hello, Anna. Starting with cricket this morning, because the Women's T20 World Cup starts on home soil in 9 days' time. And England warmed up for that tournament with a superb 6-wicket victory over India last night. Henry Moran reports from Taunton.
A partnership worth 137 between Heather Knight and Alice Capsey guided England to a record-breaking run chase against India to ensure they won this three-match series by 2-1 and head into the T20 World Cup filled with confidence. It was a partnership that was necessary as well. England at 38-3 looked to be heading for defeat, but there was a resilience, a confidence in the partnership between Capsey and Knight. Capsey eventually out for 82, Knight unbeaten at the end on 70. So England will be confident. They begin the World Cup campaign on June 12th against Sri Lanka at Edgbaston.
Well, as Henry mentioned, batter Alice Capsey will now be giving England selectors a headache after top scoring with 82 last night. Here's England captain Charlie Dean.
She was fantastic. The way she hit down the ground and cleared the rope and picked her moments as well and climbed in when she thought it was a bowler she could take on. Yeah, it was a brilliant display of batting. We've been working hard on our T20 game. You know, not having a load of bilateral cricket has allowed us to do that, and we've been really focusing in on higher chases and the reality that that's what we'll need in pressure games to get over the line in a game like this just before the World Cup starts. It's huge for the confidence.
So the Women's T20 World Cup starts a week on Friday. Next to Paris and an enthralling quarterfinal at the French Open last night.
Menchik with a drop shot to try and win it. Fonseca is there. Menchik reaches it and goes cross court, and Fonseca is beaten. Menchik. Lovely touch at the net from Jakub Menchik. And at the age of 20, he's in a first Grand Slam semi-final.
Yes, he may have needed 7 match points to get there, but the Czech 26th seed Jakub Menšík, as you heard, is now into the last 4 of the French Open. He beat Novak Djokovic's conqueror, the Brazilian teenager João Fonseca, in a third set tiebreak last night. Will now face the second seed Alexander Zverev for a place in the final. You can follow today's action from the French Open on BBC Sounds this afternoon. Finally, football, and 5 days on from Arne Slot's sacking, Liverpool are finalising the Dutchman's replacement at Anfield. They've reached a verbal agreement with the former Bournemouth boss Andoni Iraola. Meanwhile, Marco Silva has confirmed he is leaving Fulham after 5 years, is now believed to be close to taking over at Benfica. And there was one international friendly in Cardiff last night. Wales scored a late equaliser to draw 1-1 against Ghana. Ghana, remember, in England's group at the World Cup, which kicks off in North America a week tomorrow, not long to go now.
Can't wait. Mike, thank you so much. This afternoon on Radio 4, we continue to examine the world of AI.
The Artificial Human is the show that answers the questions that we all have about AI.
Could AI make it possible for anyone to be able to write their own software?
Why are we comfortable using AI ourselves, but suspicious when others do?
And could AI help us win this year's World Cup?
I'm Kevin Fong.
And I'm Alex Kratosky.
And we'll be exploring all those questions and more.
Any AI system is only ever as good as the data it is trained on and the data it has to work with.
Join us for the new series of The Artificial Human.
Wednesday afternoons at 3:30.
To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
It's just coming round to 27 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Anna Foster. And Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has condemned disorder at a protest in Southampton about the police handling of the murder of Henry Novak, describing the scenes as completely unacceptable. The student was handcuffed and arrested after he was fatally stabbed last December because his killer, Vikram Digwa, had made a false claim to the police that he had been the victim of a racist attack. Ms. Mahmood said a tragedy was being hijacked to stir up violence. Police chiefs are re-examining anti-racism commitments which have come under renewed scrutiny. The National Police Chiefs Council says it's listening to concerns raised by politicians in light of the murder of Henry Novak and says changes will be made where needed. The US and Iran have again exchanged fire, testing the fragile ceasefire between the two countries. The US military says it carried out self-defense strikes, shooting down missiles and drones aimed at ships and Gulf allies, while Iranian forces say they were responding to attacks on their territory. Microsoft says it's developed a quantum computer chip which is 1,000 times more reliable than the previous version. The tech giant says the new chip, the Majorana 2, takes it a step closer to building a commercially viable quantum machine that could solve some of the world's biggest challenges. A cross-party committee of MPs is urging the government to end its £330 million NHS data contract in England with the tech firm Palantir, citing concerns about its links to US defence and intelligence work. The Science, Innovation and Technology Committee says there's a clear mismatch with UK values and is calling for a break clause next year to be invoked. The Bank of England is asking the public to choose which animals and birds should appear on the next generation of banknotes. From today, people have a month to pick from a shortlist as wildlife replaces the historical figures that have appeared on notes for more than half a century.
Thank you, Lisa. 25-7, Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, has condemned disorder at a protest in Southampton last night over the police handling of the murder of Henry Novak. Well, Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, is here. Henry, this has sparked a big political debate, as one might expect. Just tell us a little bit more about what the Home Secretary and others have had to say on it so far.
Well, the first thing I should say is that the Home Secretary last night responded to the unrest in Southampton that we were hearing about 20 minutes or so ago from Peter from BBC South. She said the scenes this evening, this was speaking last night, were completely unacceptable. She said there can be no justification for hijacking this tragedy to stir up violence and disorder. Those responsible can expect to face the full force of the law. More generally, Anna, the political debate here is focusing increasingly around whether the police officers on the scene displayed racial bias in how they responded. That is the clear allegation from Reform UK, but also from the Conservatives, who've suggested the officers would have responded differently had the murderer been white. The government, for its part, says there is no two-tier policing in the UK, but Sir Keir Starmer has said that he wants the IOPC, the watchdog, to look at some of these questions as part of the investigation that they are conducting. He said that they should look at how accusations of racism informed the decision making in this case. There is also a political debate, though, about the appropriate way in which to raise those questions. You've had Shabana Mahmood and others citing the Novak family's statement that they did not want this to cause further division. Nigel Farage's statement yesterday said that the public should respond to this incident with pure cold rage. That's been criticised by many in politics, but among them, Kemi Badenoch, who told Newsnight last night, "I don't think that his intervention was helpful. I think we should try and depoliticise this rather than trying to whip up anger."
There are questions, Henry, about the anti-racism commitments that were published in a document last year by the National Police Chiefs Council, whether they should be looked at again, whether they are fit for purpose. What is being said about that?
Well, they are being looked at again by the NPCC. Their Chief Constable, Gavin Stevens, has said that where needed, we can and will make changes. That document calls for the police to pursue racial equity as distinguished in the document by the NPCC from racial equality. They say that racial equality means treating everyone the same or being colourblind, but they say that police should be committed to racial equity, which they say means producing a quality of policing outcomes for people from different ethnic groups. And they say that is achieved by responding to individuals and communities according to their specific needs. That was strongly criticised yesterday in the House of Commons by Chris Filt, the Conservative Shadow Home Secretary. He said that extreme activists had hijacked the policy-making process, producing a document that was morally wrong and dangerous. Interestingly, a source close to Siobhan Mahmood, the Home Secretary, has suggested that the wording in the document is clumsy, therefore giving the government's backing to that review that's being conducted by the MPCC.
Henry, thank you. We'll speak to the Crime and Policing Minister at 10 past 8 on that topic this morning.
22 minutes to 7, strikes have continued in South Lebanon despite Israel and Hezbollah accepting a US plan for a partial ceasefire. Let's speak to Lina Sinjab, our Middle East correspondent, who is in Beirut. Lina, good morning. Just to tell us, what were the aim of these strikes? What is the ongoing aim of these strikes? And then we'll get to the hopes of peace.
Well, for the Israelis, they said that the strikes on the south will not stop. It's not part of any deal. And they continue to say their message is that the strikes are against Hezbollah personnel, infrastructure, military base, to eliminate threats from Hezbollah on northern Israel. But actually, the reality on the ground is what the Lebanese see is more destruction, more evacuation orders, scorched earth policy, and they see that the Israelis are doing in south of Lebanon, just as they did in Gaza, expansion of their forces on the ground, occupation and destruction to eliminate presence of the Lebanese there and take the land for the Israelis. And we've seen that the Israelis are advancing, you know, gradually and taking more swathe of land in the south without any discussion about if they are going to leave, when they're going to leave, or why they're staying there.
So what is this partial ceasefire that Israel and Hezbollah say between them that they have accepted, at least in part?
Well, yesterday we have got so much confusion going on. We had four different versions of this ceasefire. Donald Trump announcing that there is a deal between Israel and Hezbollah and saying that he spoke through mediator to Hezbollah. Later on, Hezbollah denied that they spoke to Donald Trump and say that there is no deal unless there is, you know, comprehensive ceasefire. The Israelis say Dahiye will not be attacked in return, and northern Israel will not be attacked. The government says that, you know, there is a deal, but it will gradually lead to a comprehensive ceasefire. But the reality on the ground, it's really shaky ceasefire. Yes, Beirut as the capital was saved at this round from any attack, but it doesn't mean that, you know, later on there might be some escalation. It will be attacked again. Diplomatic efforts are ongoing. There were a fourth round of talks in the U.S. between the Israelis and the Lebanese, but the players on the ground who are deciding the fate of the country are not agreeing to, meaning Hezbollah and Israel.
Lina Sinjab in Beirut, thank you very much indeed.
19 minutes to 7, Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, is being urged by MPs and by families to make it easier to switch off targeted adverts for baby products that are put on the feeds of users who've suffered a miscarriage or a stillbirth. Henry, Hayley Compton is a BBC correspondent who's been looking into this for a while now. And what did you find, Hayley, when you started doing that?
Morning. Yes, I started looking at it about a year ago. This is something that happened to me.
I'm so sorry, Hayley. We can't. There's a bit of a problem with your line there. So do you know what? We'll sort that out and let's do something else in the meantime.
Meantime, we could do yesterday in Parliament while we get that line working up because, there are searching questions for the police after the murder of the 18-year-old student Henry Novak, according to the Prime Minister, who was speaking yesterday in Parliament, alongside the Home Secretary, who said there would be an investigation into officers' actions on the night he was killed. We're going to keep coming back to this story, of course, throughout the morning. But for now, here is Alicia McCarthy.
Henry Novak repeatedly told police he couldn't breathe as he lay handcuffed and dying after being stabbed on a Southampton street. His killer, Vikram Digwa, lied to police at the scene, claiming he'd been the victim of a racist attack. In the Commons, the Home Secretary, Siobhan Mahmood, said many MPs and the public would by now have seen the police body-worn camera footage in which Henry tells officers he's been stabbed.
It is, without question, a disturbing and tragic thing to see. People are rightly asking questions about how the situation was handled, and they are shocked and disquieted to hear Henry's words, "I can't breathe." I know that it is difficult to wait any longer for answers, but there is a proper process to assess whether there have been incidents of police misconduct.
So there'd be an investigation by the Independent Office of Police Conduct to look at what could and should have been done differently. Vikram Digwa was jailed for a minimum of 21 years after stabbing Henry in the heart with an 8-inch blade that he said he carried as part of his Sikh faith. The case has sparked accusations of two-tier policing, favouring one community over another. Shabana Mahmood said officers had a sacred duty to police without fear or favour.
Everyone in this country is equal before the law. It is the promise upon which our whole justice system rests, and the equality of every citizen is the foundation on which the openness, tolerance and generosity of this country rests.
The Shadow Home Secretary, the Conservative Chris Philp, said the police had seemed more concerned with the accusation of racism than with helping Henry.
We cannot tolerate a situation where false allegations of racism by criminals are believed. We cannot allow the colour of someone's skin to be a consideration in how the police or other public services treat people.
Henry Novak's constituency MP, Labour's Jen Craft, paid tribute to him and his family.
A bright young man at the start of a life that held so much promise. Yeah. The turnout at his funeral and the outpouring of community support show that he had an impact well beyond his young years. Yeah. I'd like to pay tribute to his family, Mark Novak particularly, his father. Many here have quoted his words, calling that Henry's death does not lead to more division and hatred.
And speaking for the Lib Dems, Max Wilkinson urged MPs to keep those words in mind. But he was heckled by Reform UK members when he took a swipe at the party's leader, Nigel Farage, who had earlier said the treatment of Henry Novak was evidence of a two-tier culture.
We have seen the Honourable Member for Clacton once again using tragedy to divide British communities. We all know why he does this. He's made a career out of this and has become rich as a result. But we are also well aware, as he is, that his actions are divisive, dangerous and fundamentally un-British.
A Labour MP, Tan Desi, accused parties like Reform UK and Restore Britain of attacking the Sikh community.
And they've decided to scapegoat and throw under the bus an entire community based on the actions of one violent murderer. And let me also give them a history...
The Speaker, Sir Lindsay Hoyle, stepping in there as Reform's Deputy Leader Richard Tice yelled rubbish at Tan Desi as he made his accusations. Reform UK's Robert Jenrick asked the Home Secretary,
"Will she return to equality before the law for all? And will she say that when it comes to public safety, white lives matter just as much as anyone else's?"
But Shabana Mahmood didn't see it like that.
"I don't think this is a moment to pit white Britons against non-white Britons."
Shabana Mahmood said it was instead a moment to reflect on a horrific tragedy, and she insisted everyone was equal under the law.
"That applies regardless of the colour of your skin. That applies whether you're a non-white Brit whose family arrived here 50 years ago or 10 years ago, or if you're a white Brit whose family have been here for about 300 years or more."
And she reckoned that principle of equality was one everyone should back.
That was Alicia McCarthy reporting on Yesterday in Parliament. Brings us to 14 minutes to seven.
Let's go back to Hayley Compton, a BBC correspondent who's been examining the fact that if you're on Meta, which owns Facebook, Instagram, those sorts of sites, and you have been perhaps looking for things to do with your pregnancy, your birth, your newborn, if you suffer a miscarriage or a stillbirth, it's enormously difficult to switch those ads off. Basically, you can't do it. And so they keep coming up on your feed and it can be really distressing for parents. So, Hayley, tell us what you found when you started looking into this.
Well, exactly. I spoke to women up and down the country who were all telling me the same thing, that as soon as they typed in any sort of pregnancy question into a search engine, like when is my due date or what should or shouldn't I be eating, then they were served up all of these different baby and maternity related adverts. that when they went through a loss, like a stillbirth or a miscarriage, it was incredibly difficult to turn that off. And lots of the women told me that they tried everything to see if they could kind of switch these things off. And the answer isn't just to stop going on social media, because a lot of these women go on social media for escapism, to even tell friends and family about their loss, and to find support, because having baby through it is quite a lonely place to be, and you want to seek out people that are going through the same experiences that you are having. Now, Meta have said that you can switch off these adverts through your settings if you were a Facebook user, but it's actually quite a lengthy process. And many of the women did tell me that they'd done these things, and on Instagram it's on keywords, and they were still being served up these baby related adverts days, weeks and months after their babies had died. Now what's happening is the government's newly appointed maternity advisor, Michelle Welsh MP, has written to Meta calling on them to meet with these families and to stop this from happening, because it can be incredibly re-traumatising and hurtful and very intrusive. And Meta have said since that their systems are designed to share the most relevant and useful content to users, but they aren't perfect, and some ads may occasionally appear inconsiderate, and they are continuing to improve how those ads are delivered. But I think it might be worth them meeting with these families and finding out exactly what they can do to protect vulnerable users like those going through baby loss.
Thank you. That's Hayley Compton there.
It's 11 minutes to 7. MPs on the Science, Innovation and Technology Committee say that the UK is too dependent on an American data giant called Palantir. It's a controversial company working closely with the Trump administration's immigration enforcement plans and the government of Israel, among others. And its founders, Alex Karp and Peter Thiel, who continues as chair, are huge figures in modern Silicon Valley and have been very outspoken about the need to defend Western civilization. But the company has also been effective, including during COVID, in its work in the health service, as the report from this committee actually acknowledges. And it's been rewarded by the government with hundreds of millions of dollars in contracts. Let's speak to Dame Chi Onwuru, who is the chair of the Science, Innovation and Technology Committee, whose report is out today. Dame Onwuru, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. You make clear the report, I was looking through it, you make clear that your central objection to Palantir is not ideological. It's not that you consider some of the other work that they do to be immoral, if indeed you do. What is your central concern?
So my committee launched its inquiry into the government's digital ambitions, you know, to rewire the state and to create, as it says, a truly digital state. And as part of that, we identified building blocks and barriers to achieving an ambition that we support. And one of the key key barriers is around legacy systems and vendor locking. And Palantir is symptomatic of a dependency on a small number of US companies, which means that we haven't got the, means are more, so more likely to be locked in. The key thing about vendor locking, and in a particular instance of Palantir, is remember that it started off during COVID by offering to aggregate the NHS's data for basically for free, for £1. And as part of that, it is sort of, we heard evidence that it's integrated itself into the NHS, and the data, the federated data platform is a critical part of the infrastructure. So the key issue for us here is that when you have vendor locking, and particularly with a company like Palantir, which lacks public trust and lacks the trust of some of the NHS providers. When you have vendor locking, then you are always going to end up with worse services for more, paying more money because you can't negotiate.
But isn't the problem, is there something a little bit bizarre about this, Dame Onwuru, which is that people might say the issue here is with the British state, not with Palantir. Palantir come along, they're very open about their politics. Alex Karp isn't exactly a shy and retiring fellow. He's been very outspoken. They do the work, and then the British state keeps coming back to them for more and more and more. I mean, in a sense, can you blame Palantir for coming back and doing the highly paid work that he gets paid to do by the British state?
No, I certainly don't blame Palantir for looking to maximise its profits and to ensure that the British state is locked into its products and services. I do think, and to come to the second part of our objections in terms of Palantir's 22-point manifesto, which sets out the company's moral duty to defend the United States, advocates militarism and hard power. I do think that a company with a mission, with an ideological and political mission, is a double risk for the state, and particularly in the critical infrastructure, which is our NHS, as part of our transformation from analog to digital. But it is up to the state, and this is the key point of our report. It is up to the state to have the right building blocks in place, and that includes the right skills within the state. It includes the right knowing how we're spending the $25 billion that we spend on digital, which isn't being tracked and monitored, and it includes addressing our legacy infrastructure, and it includes ensuring that we are not dependent on a single company.
So a lot for the British state to do. Damon, we really appreciate your joining us. Thank you. And I should say that we've got the UK boss of Palantir, Louis Mosley, joining us at 10 to 8. Thank you.
Just coming round to 6 minutes to seven, the number of children at private schools has fallen by around 30,000 since the government started charging VAT on fees. This has come from a census by the Independent Schools Council. Julie Robinson is its CEO. Good morning.
Morning.
Are you able to dig any more deeply into those figures? Because, for example, pupil numbers are falling across the board, state schools as well, because of demographic change. Primary numbers have been in decline since around about 2018, 2019. So how do you know what this is driven by?
We know there are a range of factors at play. Of course there are, but this change is the biggest reduction in pupil numbers across independent schools since ISC records began, and it can't be explained by demographic changes alone. 20,000 children are down over the last academic year, so that means tens of thousands of children moving schools, families facing difficult financial decisions, and a reduction of education choices. And what we're seeing from these figures is that children are having to change friendship groups, and there's disruption to communities.
The government points out that by ending tax breaks, and this is what they were intending to do, to deliver more money for education in state schools, 94% of children in state schools, they say it's raising more than forecast, more than £1.8 billion a year by 2029-2030. What is your argument against why that shouldn't be happening?
Well, the government's estimate was a reduction by 37,000 pupils across the first 5 years after tax policy changes came into effect. And this evidence now suggests the impact is greater than predicted, and the state schools aren't seeing the benefit.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the pupil numbers, as we were saying, are falling, but there are actually more private schools opening than closing. There certainly were in 2025.
Well, that school closures figure that might be quoted includes specialist special needs schools. So if we look at mainstream schools only, over the last year, there's a net loss of over 60 of those.
Mm. Why would we take the special needs schools out of that equation?
Well, we know that there's a huge amount of pressure on delivering educational opportunity and care for special needs children across the country. You know, there's huge pressure on the state sector. So it's important that we see what we're seeing is lots of pressure on special needs. So there is a lot of demand for new special schools to come in. But we should take them out of these figures because specialist special needs schools are not subject to VAT in the same way that mainstream schools are.
So what are you saying to the government in the ongoing conversations that you're presumably having with them?
Well, in an ideal world, we'd want reversal of these tax policies and at least a review. But we're looking for greater recognition of the role that independent schools play in helping to deliver on the government's educational priorities. For instance, there's lots of partnership working across the country, which sees schools of all kinds working together in the community to broaden educational opportunities for all children. And we really want to see more of that.
Julie Robinson, the CEO of the Independent Schools Council. Thanks for joining us.
on BBC iPlayer.
Gareth.
Simple question, really. Do you think you're up to this?
A brand new drama starring Joseph Fiennes and Jodie Whittaker.
Everyone thinks that footballers are overconfident, arrogant. They're afraid.
Based on the award-winning play.
Keep believing. Keep going right up until the final whistle. A new England that comes from behind, that fights.
Dear England.
Are England's young lions ready for the game of their lives?
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
Let's check the weather. Here's Simon King.
Anna, thanks so much indeed. Low pressure moving in for the next couple of days. It means it's going to turn really quite unsettled. It's going to feel quite cool and fresh with a pretty strong wind to go with it as well. For southwest England, Wales, the West Midlands and northwest England, we're starting to see some rain now moving its way into the far west of Wales and southwest England. That rain is going to move its way gradually eastward fairly quickly over the next few hours. It will clear away to the east, but then following behind will be some showers, and those could be quite heavy, perhaps even thundery in parts of northwest England. There'll be some sunny spells, but those will be pretty limited. And it's going to turn pretty windy with maximum temperatures of 16 to 18 degrees. For southeast England, the East Midlands, Eastern and Northeast England, it's a dry start actually, but we'll see some showery rain moving its way in by mid-morning and moving its way eastward. Much of that's going to clear eastward by the early part of this afternoon. Some sunnier spells developing, but again, showers, which could be heavy and even thundery at times in northeast England. Quite breezy, temperatures of 17 to 20 Celsius. For Northern Ireland, it's already very wet here this morning. Some heavy rain for a time before that rain moves north and eastward into southwestern Scotland, where again that rain could be pretty heavy through this morning. It will clear away to the northeast from southwest Scotland and Northern Ireland, and again there'll be some frequent showers moving through. Blustery conditions, temperatures 15 to 17 degrees. For northern and eastern Scotland, after a dry start, rain moves in by mid-morning, turning pretty heavy, possibly even a bit thundery into the afternoon, and temperatures today getting up to about 14 to 16 degrees Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Amol Rajan.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Wednesday, the 3rd of June. The headlines this morning: the Home Secretary has condemned crowds who threw bricks at police during a protest over the handling of Henry Novak's murder. Microsoft says it's taken a leap forward in its quantum computing with a new chip, which is 1,000 times more reliable than its last one. We'll hear from the company and our technology editor after the news. And the United States and Iran have both carried out missile attacks, putting their ceasefire under further strain.
Also coming up in the next hour, the UK boss of tech firm Palantir responds to calls from MPs for its £330 million NHS contract to be terminated. The ancient microbes still alive inside a 5,000-year-old frozen mummy, and what they tell us about science today. And the animals that could replace the likes of Winston Churchill and Jane Austen on our banknotes. Yeah, that'll be the common frog, the grey seal and the barn owl. We'll tell you about the others who did and didn't make the cut and why indeed they've been chosen. Hoping to top that with the BBC News is Lisa Costello.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has condemned disorder at a protest in Southampton about the police handling of the murder of Henry Novak, describing the scenes as completely unacceptable. The student was handcuffed and arrested after he was fatally stabbed last December because his killer, Vikram Digwa, had lied to police that he'd been racially attacked. Our correspondent Tim Moffat reports.
About 200 to 300 people gathered outside Southampton police station. They heard speeches by figures including the far-right activist Tommy Robinson, whose real name is Stephen Yaxley Lennon. The crowds chanted, "Justice for Henry." The crowd then moved away, about a mile and a half into the suburbs and close to the family home of Vikram Digwa, the killer of Henry Novak. Bins, some bricks and an e-scooter were thrown at police. While officers with riot shields and batons attempted to hold a line along a street. Posting on social media, the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, condemned those involved in the disturbances. She said there could be no justification for hijacking the tragedy of Henry Novak's death to stir up violence and disorder.
Police chiefs say they're re-examining anti-racism commitments which suggested officers should treat ethnic minorities differently in order to ensure equality of outcomes. The National Police Chiefs Council says it's listening to concerns raised by politicians in light of the murder of Henry Novak. Here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
Last year, the National Police Chiefs Council published a document of anti-racism commitments. Racism, it said, is a very real issue in policing, and achieving equality of outcomes for people of different ethnic groups does not mean treating everyone the same, but responding to their specific circumstances and experiences. It's not formal policy or training, but the Conservatives said it was wrong to treat people differently based on the colour of their skin. A source close to the Home Secretary said the wording in the document was clumsy, and the chair of the NPCC, Chief Constable Gavin Stevens, said where needed we can and will make changes. That review is part of a wider focus on the police's response to allegations of racism in the wake of Henry Novak's death. Kemi Badenoch told Newsnight it should be a moment like Stephen Lawrence's murder that prompted a change in the police's approach. Reform UK's Nigel Farage, writing in The Telegraph, said it should be a watershed in confronting what he said was a two-tier culture where some groups receive greater protection than others.
Microsoft says it's developed a quantum computer chip which is 1,000 times more reliable than the previous version. Quantum computing uses the principles of particle physics to create a new type of computer which is able to solve problems ordinary computers can't. The tech giant says the new chip, the Majorana 2, takes it a step closer to building a commercially viable machine. Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman, reports.
The computing power in a quantum machine comes from tiny, delicate units called qubits. They operate in a very fragile state and usually last just a few milliseconds. But Microsoft claims the qubits on its new Majorana 2 chip can survive for 20 seconds, giving them a lot more time to process complex calculations. This has been made possible by substituting aluminium on the chip for lead. The aim is that one day quantum computers will help solve big problems such as how to get rid of microplastics and come up with formulas for new fertilisers to help farmers grow more food. It's a multi-million pound industry already, although nobody has a powerful model yet.
A committee of MPs wants the government to end its NHS data contract in England with the tech giant Palantir. The company has deep links in US defence and security, and the Science, Innovation and Technology Committee has said that there's a clear mismatch with UK values. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
NHS England awarded Palantir the seven-year data contract, which includes helping the management of hospital waiting lists, in 2023. But there's a break clause early next year, which the Commons Committee proposes the government uses to appoint a company it describes as more compatible with UK values. It says the reliance on a small number of US-based providers poses a clear vulnerability. Palantir said its platform had provided benefits for patients. The government said it was speeding up diagnoses and treatment.
The US military says it's carried out self-defence strikes on Iran, shooting down ballistic missiles and drones fired at ships and at Gulf allies. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard said it had only been responding to a strike on its territory. The incidents highlight the fragile nature of the current ceasefire, as our North America correspondent Peter Bowes reports.
US Central Command said two Iranian missiles fired towards Kuwait fell short or broke apart in flight, while three missiles launched at Bahrain were intercepted by American and Bahraini air defense systems. Kuwait hosts several US bases and has been frequently targeted by Iran during the conflict. The US military also said its forces carried out self-defense strikes against an Iranian military ground control station on Keshma Island in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran says the target was a communications tower south of the island and has cited that attack as the reason for its retaliation. Earlier, US forces fired on an oil tanker attempting to sail towards Iran's oil terminal at Karg Island. Officials said the Botswana-flagged vessel was disabled by a missile strike on its engine room after ignoring repeated warnings to alter course.
Russia says its air defences have been responding to a Ukrainian drone attack on the area around St. Petersburg, which is hosting an international conference. The regional governor said 50 drones had been brought down. New research suggests that doing 90 minutes to 2 hours of weight training each week can greatly reduce the risk of an early death. The British Journal of Sports Medicine has published analysis of data from decades-long studies indicating that regular resistance or weight training can affect your risk of death from heart disease, stroke and neurological disease. Our health correspondent Dominic Hughes has more.
The researchers looked at data from nearly 150,000 people over 30 years. They found those doing 90 minutes to 2 hours of weight training weekly lowered the risk of death from any cause by 13%. This was 19% lower for cardiovascular disease, such as from a heart attack or stroke, and 27% lower for a neurological disease. This observational study doesn't distinguish between cause and effect, but the researchers say there's growing evidence about the benefits of combining aerobic exercise and strength training.
Scientists studying the remains of Ötzi, the iceman who died more than 5,000 years ago, say some of the ancient microbes inside his body may still be alive. Tests are needed to confirm whether the microscopic life they've identified is still viable, but researchers say it's possible because some bacteria can remain dormant for thousands of years. More from Helen Briggs.
In 1991, two German hikers discovered a body in the snowy Alps on the border between Austria and Italy. The perfectly preserved 5,000-year-old mummy, named Ötzi, has been kept frozen in a museum ever since, and scientists from the research institute URAC in Bolzano in Italy are slowly unravelling his secrets. Their new analysis of tissue and skin samples shows he's not just a frozen relic. His body hosts a complicated mixture of microbes, some of which might still be alive. The scientists say this will help us understand how so-called friendly bacteria, important for optimal health, have evolved.
Helen Briggs reporting.
Lisa, thanks so much. The time now is 9 minutes past seven. As you may have heard from Lisa there, there have been protests and violent clashes in Southampton overnight, close to where 18-year-old Henry Novak was murdered. A crowd of several hundred initially gathered outside the city's central police station, and among those were the far-right activist Tommy Robinson and the actor-turned-activist Lawrence Fox.
Go on, Tommy!
Later, protesters marched across the city to the St. Denis area, close to where Henry was murdered in December, and that's where things turned violent. Chairs, cans and flares were thrown at officers in riot gear, forcing them to retreat. Well, central to the contention of those protesters is the idea that Britain lives under, in their phrase, two-tier justice, with white people, like 18-year-old Henry Novak, accorded lower status than black people like George Floyd, even though the former is British and the latter American. They argue that all those politicians who took the knee, or corporations who changed their logos, usually for a day or two, and keyboard warriors who posted themselves alongside pictures of murals of Floyd, have been unforgivably silent about a British teenager uttering in an unbearable echo the same words as Floyd: "I can't breathe." They say, the protesters, is that this is racist and that it flows directly from the supposed anti-racism of DEI programs, that's diversity, equity and inclusion, such as those programs that police are now required to undertake. The guidance on such matters comes from the NPCC, that's the National Police Chiefs Council, and the College of Policing. Well, let's speak now to Palm Sandhu, who is the director of the London Policing College and a former chief superintendent in the Metropolitan Police. Miss Sandhu, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's obviously a very highly charged atmosphere in Southampton overnight. Just on a practical level, thinking about what happened last night, what would you like to see politicians do to calm the situation down?
I think that policing has become very, very politicalised, and I think the politicians need to step away and let the police deal with this. Even when you look at Henry Novak's father, Mark Novak. He has appealed for calm. He's appealed for lessons to be learnt and for the streets to be made safer for everyone going forward, not for what we can see now, not for the demonstrations, and not for all these politicians who are just coming out with all these comments that are inflaming the situation. When I first watched that video, I was so upset, distressed, because you see a young person losing their life, and then you see a police officer who is being blamed for it completely. No police officer would go to work and think, I am going to watch a young person bleed out in front of me today and not do something about it. I just do not accept that.
Can I ask you, can I put to you the central argument made by some of the protesters who gathered last night? Their argument, their position is that we live in this country with, their phrase, two-tier justice, and that white people are discriminated against by the police. Is that fair?
I do not accept that at all. Police officers do not go to work and think, if I see a black person, a white person, I am going to treat them differently. They go to work and they deal with emergency situations where they have to make fast time decisions where it is life or death. And in this case, obviously, they've made a tragic mistake that's ended it up in the loss of a young life. They make those decisions, but they do not base those on the skin colour of the individuals in front of them.
What does the police guidance on racism get right and what does it get wrong?
The guidance on the racism is more about teaching people to understand different cultures. It doesn't say you treat people differently. It says take into account different cultures. Because if you're dealing with somebody who's deaf, blind, because it doesn't just cater for skin colour. If you're dealing with somebody who's deaf or blind, what is the point of either shouting louder or showing them something that's written down? You have to cater for that individual's needs, and that's what the equality and race training is about.
But the argument of some people, including the Conservatives yesterday, Kemi Badenoch and Chris Philp, the Shadow Home Secretary, is that the very fact that that guidance exists injects a kind of racialised element. It injects a kind of hyper-consciousness of racial differences, where in fact the idea should be to take race out of the equation and try to treat everybody equally under the law, despite their race.
You treat people equally. That means that you do not afford that deaf person access to British Sign Language or anything like that. You can't do that. You have to treat people according to their needs. If you've got somebody in a wheelchair, you wouldn't ask them to stand up and be searched. You've got to take into account different people's characteristics. This has been used, the race guidance has been used to politicalise what has happened in this tragedy.
You gave many, many decades of service to the police, and in a sense this is a question for politicians rather than someone like you who is in the police. But can I put to you again what the protesters say, which is that they are very struck by the difference between the reaction of individuals, of politicians and of corporations to the death of George Floyd compared to Henry Novak. How do you reflect on that sharp difference, the people that didn't take the knee, the murals that weren't painted and so on?
I do not accept that there is two-tier policing in this country, and I do not accept that police officers go to work thinking, I am going to watch a young person bleed out, and I do not accept that police officers will go there and treat people differently based on their skin colour. If a crime is being committed, they will deal with it. In this case, they failed because they didn't act on the all of the evidence that was in front of them, and that's where the tragedy is.
Vikram Digwa, the killer, lied repeatedly in court, including saying that he carried a murder weapon for religious reasons. There's been an interesting debate that's emerged about whether or not the kirpan, which is a Sikh religious ornament or instrument, should be banned. Just to be very clear, it wasn't the kirpan that killed Henry Novak. What's your view as to whether or not the kirpan should be banned in this country?
You are going to have individuals who are going to commit crimes. That does not mean that they represent the whole of that community or the whole of that faith. You are always going to have individuals who are obsessed with knives. And we've got a knife crime epidemic in this country. We need to look at the bigger picture. You cannot say that all Sikhs should not carry the kirpan because of what this individual has done in this case. And he did not use the kirpan.
Palm Sandhu, Director of the London Policing College, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
We'll get the thoughts of the government after 8 o'clock. Sarah Jones, the Minister for Policing and Crime, will join us at 8:10. It's 17 minutes past seven now. Microsoft has unveiled a new chip, which it says is game-changing in the race to build a quantum computer. Nobody's actually managed it yet, but the tech company now says it thinks it can do it by the end of the decade. Not everybody believes that claim, but they are interested because that type of machine would be so much more powerful than the ones we use right now. Zoe Kleinman is our technology editor. I always think it's worth, Zoe, just explaining when we talk about quantum computers, how they are so many light years away, in theory, from what we're using now.
Well, they have been quite a few years away from where we are now, for quite a few years. I think the tech companies talk them up a lot and say, you know, they're coming and they're imminent, but they're not here yet. Microsoft today is saying that it thinks it might have a working, high-functioning quantum computer that it can scale up in the next 3 years by 2029. Now, if so, the way things are at the moment, that would put it, you know, definitely up there with a world leader in quantum. But as you say, nobody actually has one at the moment that can do very much. They're all kind of babies, if you like, in their infancy. But the hope for them is that they'll be able to do massive calculations and solve big kind of world problems that quantum experts say classical computers, the computers we have now, simply can't do because they're too big. You know, we're talking about the big issues, how to get rid of microplastics, how to create new formulas for fertilizers so that farmers can grow more food and eradicate famine, those sorts of things. They're not designed to replace existing computers. You know, your phone or your laptop won't become a quantum computer, but they're designed to sort of work on that really big stuff, if you like. Now, Microsoft says that its new chip, the Majorana 2, is a big breakthrough in its 20-year and counting journey to try to figure out how to build one of these machines. What it's done is it's swapped aluminium for lead, and it says this makes the qubits on the chip, those are the bits that do the computer processing, last a lot longer, and that basically means they can do a lot more. So Microsoft described this to me as being like going from a phone that you charge every day to one that you charge every few years. But in this case, in the quantum case, we're talking about tiny amounts of time. We're talking about seconds and milliseconds. Here's Jason Zander, who's the head of Microsoft Quantum and Discovery.
Now, this particular chip is designed to be a breakthrough in reliability. And with this chip, one of the things that's super important is how long can a qubit last while it's doing compute. With this chip, we have a mean time of 20 seconds and up to a minute that's measured. And just to put that in perspective, most of the quantum computing modalities that are out there, the other hardware types, are lucky to get into the millisecond range. And why is that important? Because the longer the qubit can stay stable and reliable, the easier it is for it to do computation.
Mm. The thing is, Zoe, as we mentioned, not everybody in the tech sector believes that.
No. So quantum, on the whole, is quite a strange part of science. And Microsoft's approach to quantum is equally quite strange. They're basing it on a 90-year-old physics theory about a new state of matter, so an alternative to gas and liquids and solids. It's called the Majorana particle. And Microsoft claims that it's created it, and that is what underpins their quantum chip, right? They've called it the Majorana 2 chip. But lots of scientists simply just don't believe them. They don't believe that they've done it. They think, you know, this whole thing is still in the realms of theory. So Microsoft has stood by it 100%. It still insists that it's telling the truth. It says it's shared all of its work now with the US Defense Agency, DARPA, to verify its findings. But I think it's going to have a job convincing everybody. Here is Dr. Henry Legg, who's a physicist from the University of St. Andrews.
The scientific community is very skeptical about this, even whether or not they've achieved a single qubit. And to create a fully functioning quantum computer, they claim they are years and not decades away. I think it's more like decades and probably many decades before they get to that goal, if at all.
That's Dr. Henry Legg, and thanks to our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
That brings us to 21 minutes past seven. It is an extraordinary moment in the modern history of capitalism. There are these blockbuster IPOs. That is the moment where companies become public. And across the UK, individuals, you will have the chance to buy shares in a company that's about to join an American stock market. That company is Elon Musk's SpaceX. Sean Farrington has more on this and the other blockbuster IPOs that are around at the moment, Sean.
Well, there's loads, and none of it really taken into account what was just being discussed about the quantum computing and all of that. Elon Musk watching that stuff closely, but he is more interested in raising money at the minute for SpaceX, this business of his that isn't just space shuttles, remember. It includes the communications business, Starlink. It has Musk's XAI, artificial intelligence business. It's got Grok and X as well, formerly Twitter, all under that watch. He wants to raise about $70 billion for it. It would value the business at around $1.8 trillion. So he's got a lot of people to convince to invest in this. So people here in the UK, for the first time, they'll see the likes of Hargreaves Lansdown, AJ Bell, eToro push the opportunity to invest in one of these companies joining an American stock market. But of course, with all of that, there are risks as well. Eileen Burbage, founding partner of tech investor Passion Capital and now NFG Ventures, joins us now. Eileen, morning. Why is this being opened up to British individuals?
Morning. There's two reasons. I think one is that the positioning of the company is that they would like to democratize access and give the retail investors who have long supported or followed Elon Musk access to the opportunity. But I think a more cynical view would be, given that the company is aiming to raise almost double the amount of money that was raised in all of the U.S. public offerings of 2025 combined, that they need to actually open up access to as many channels as possible in order to raise the amount they're aiming for, which is, you know, $80 billion.
Does that mean the risks are bigger for people who are thinking about getting involved, given the scale of what Musk is trying to achieve? I mean, this is a business that hasn't made any money yet, despite, you know, leading in many innovations.
I think that means that the access or exposure to the risk for retail investors or everyday investors is coming sooner than it would otherwise be. Given that the company is listing its shares, the retail investors would eventually have access to buy these shares almost right away in the day of the listing. This book building exercise, or the access, which is unprecedented and the first time it's happening, means that UK retail investors will have the opportunity to buy the shares even before the day of the listing. Having said that, they've also always had exposure through investment vehicles such as Scottish Mortgage, even Baillie Gifford. Both of those UK vehicles have had great exposure to SpaceX for years now.
So what's your, you know, there'll be many conversations to be had about this and all the other massive tech businesses that Amol was alluding to after huge amounts of money from investors as well. But what's your take this morning on the fact that, you know, British individuals are going to be more exposed to this kind of conversation in the coming weeks?
I mean, it does lay the option at the feet of British retail investors. So I think a lot of people will say that that's the capital markets at work and that that's a positive thing. Do you think retail investors should continue to consider for fundamentals of the business? And as you emphasize, this company hasn't ever been profitable. It is aiming to get to a market cap that's roughly about the third of that of Nvidia, which is the world's most expensive or valuable company, but with only a tenth of the revenue and no profitability, which Nvidia has been profitable for quite some time.
Eileen, thank you very much for your time this morning. Eileen Burbage there from NFG Ventures. Worth mentioning, there's a lot to mention on the back of that, that some analysts think it could be worth half of that $1.8 trillion. So all worth bearing in mind.
Yeah, it is. Thank you, Sean. It's 25 past seven. Scientists have made an exciting discovery inside the body of a frozen ice age man who was found perfectly preserved in the Alps. Ötzi, the Iceman, and he's known, was actually dug up back in 1991, and he's been frozen and studied ever since. But inside, there are microbes which it seems have survived being frozen for all of those thousands of years. Dr. Pontus Skoglund is an ancient DNA specialist at the Francis Crick Institute. Good morning.
Good morning.
And something like this for you to work on and study must be, well, enormously exciting, the things that you can learn from him.
Absolutely. This Iceman Ötzi is quite unique because there's so much soft tissue preserved. And that makes researchers able to access the DNA of his gut and look at his gut microbiome that he had. And they see that it matches what they call a non-westernized diet, one that doesn't have as much ultra-processed food and other things.
And when we talk about these microbes surviving, does that mean they're still functioning? What does it mean?
Absolutely not. So, for example, the DNA that the researchers access here is broken down into little bits of these DNA letters, only 50 or so letters long. So no chance of it being resurrected. And the same goes for more dangerous bacteria that we can see sometimes even in the skeleton of ancient remains.
Yeah. What does it tell us that can be useful now, those comparisons that you're talking about making?
Yeah, absolutely. The Iceman didn't die from an infection, so he died from being shot in the back, basically, murdered potentially. But many people in this time period, 5,000 years ago, and even until about 100 or a couple of hundred years ago, would have died from infections. And it's increasingly realized that this might have been a driver of immune evolution. For example, why we have many genetic risk factors involved in the immune system that predisposes people to autoimmune disease today, and maybe actually many other diseases.
I see what you mean. And you were saying, you were talking about his microbiome and the kind of diet that he had at that time. And that makes you believe that actually he wasn't from the place where he was found.
Yeah, that's a bit uncertain. His ancestry matches that of these people in Stone Age farming Europe. He was found on the border of the Austrian and Italian Alps. He may not have been far from there, but he may also have been a traveller on the way somewhere.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can learn, isn't it? Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Pontus Skoglund. He was an ancient DNA specialist at the Francis Crick Institute.
28 minutes past seven, and time to say good morning again to Mike Williams, who's got the sport.
Hello, Amol. We know a big summer of sport is ahead of us. The World Cup begins a week tomorrow. The Women's T20 Cricket World Cup starts in 9 days' time. Wimbledon, of course, at the end of the month. And in exactly 50 days' time, the Commonwealth Games will get underway in Glasgow. And I'm delighted to say that we can speak to Phil Batty, the Chief Executive of Glasgow 2026, who joins us live on the programme now. Hi, Phil.
Good morning.
So these, as we know, are slimmed down games, aren't they, after Glasgow stepped in to host them following the Australian state of Victoria's decision to pull out in 2023. How different will these streamlined games feel and look?
Well, we've had 2 years to put on the Commonwealth Games compared to a normal six. But the great thing is it's happening in Glasgow, which is one of the most fantastic event cities on earth. And whilst it's a different size and shape, it's got 10 incredible sports in the programme, six of them fully integrated with parasport. And there's 215 gold medals up for grabs. So it's a pretty packed 11 days of sport here in Scotland this summer.
Yeah, and unique, as you say, with those parasports integrated with the main schedule. Are you disappointed, though, Phil, that all this great live sport from Glasgow is not going to be broadcast on free-to-air TV, the Commonwealth Games, not on the BBC for the first time ever? You'll have to pay to watch the action on TNT. Are you worried that's going to make it less visible?
So we've entered a partnership with Warner Brothers Discovery, so you'll have the games broadcast on HBO Max, which is available across the UK and Europe. We also will have free-to-air highlights, and more details will be announced on that in the next 24, 48 hours. So it's a different way to consume the sport. But what it does mean is, compared to when it was on the BBC back in 2022, and there was 300 hours of coverage, there's 600 hours of every sport, every day, live streamed across the programme. So particularly for the breadth of sports in our programme, it's going to be an amazing way to see all those incredible athletes from across the Commonwealth.
But just to repeat the point, you will have to pay to watch the action. Just on a personal level, are you disappointed to not continue your partnership with the BBC? The Commonwealth Games have been on the BBC since they started in 1954. Are you sad to see that the BBC clearly don't have your tournament, your competition as much as a priority now?
We've had a great relationship with the BBC over the years and over various editions of the Games, but the way that people consume sport is changing, and we were really pleased that when we went out to the world and said, who wants to broadcast the Commonwealth Games in the UK? We've got some great partners in Warner Brothers Discovery, but we've also got some great international broadcasters, Channel 7, Sky New Zealand TV. So it really is going to be broadcast right across the Commonwealth, and there are 74 nations and territories, and we hope they all get behind their incredible athletes.
And how are ticket sales going? 50 days out.
Really strong. You can't get a track cycling or paratrack cycling ticket for love nor money. But we've just done our final ticket drop yesterday. So there's a whole new load of athletics tickets and para-athletics tickets that are out. The first medal of the games on the first day is para powerlifting. That's never happened in the history of the Commonwealth Games. So get a ticket for Friday, the 24th of July. And there's a PAC program at the SEC, along with an amazing swimming and para swimming program too. So really confident that we'll have packed venues throughout the games this summer, but there's still time with that final ticket drop to get those last few tickets.
Well, good luck with your final preparations for the Commonwealth Games. Phil Batty there, Chief Executive of Glasgow 2026. Many thanks for joining us on the programme. We'll be covering the Commonwealth Games here. That is for certain. And just to say to mark your card, in the next hour of the programme, hearing a very special feature with the celebrated sports illustrator Paul Trevelyan. He has been drawing the world's biggest sports for over 7 decades. Anna Enamel, you definitely recognise his drawings. Very distinctive style. He's into his 90s now. He's got a new book out all about the upcoming World Cup with some fantastic pictures. He's a real character and we'll hear from him at 8.25.
Oh, good, looking forward to that. Thank you, Mike. It's 28 minutes to 8 now. As is usual on a Wednesday morning, pleased to say that Michael Burke joins us in the studio to tell us about tonight's Moral Maze. Morning, Michael.
Morning, Anna. Morning, Amel. We may well soon have a seventh Prime Minister in a decade, as well as going on £3 trillion of debt and decaying infrastructure, where modernising trains, power stations, runways, reservoirs, defence seems next to impossible. If the five-year electoral cycle leads politicians to prioritise short-term concessions over solving long-term problems, has 24-hour news and social media hysteria shortened even that shelf life? Who's to blame, them or us? More to the point, who can stop us mortgaging the future for an increasingly ramshackle present? The Moral Maze after the news at 8 tonight.
Look forward to that, Michael. Thank you very much indeed. Coming up in the next half hour, is President Trump getting close to a deal with Iran? Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, will join us after the news.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Anna Foster. And at 27 minutes to 8, Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has said disorder at a protest in Southampton about the police handling of Henry Novak's murder was completely unacceptable. Two people were arrested during clashes with police. 18-year-old Henry Novak was fatally stabbed in Southampton last December, but was arrested by police when they arrived because his killer, Vikram Digwa, had made a false claim that he had been the victim of a racist attack. Ms. Mahmood said a tragedy was being hijacked to stir up violence. Police chiefs are re-examining anti-racism commitments which have come under renewed scrutiny. The National Police Chiefs Council says it's listening to concerns raised by politicians in light of the murder of Henry Novak and says changes will be made where needed. Microsoft says it's developed a quantum computing chip which it claims is 1,000 times more reliable than its predecessor. The company says the new chip, known as Majorana 2, brings it a step closer to building commercially viable quantum computers capable of tackling some of the world's most complex scientific and technological challenges. Russia says it's brought down 50 Ukrainian drones around St. Petersburg. Sources in Ukraine say an oil terminal was hit. That's not been confirmed, but videos appear to show the facility on fire. A cross-party committee of MPs is urging the government to end its £330 million NHS data contract in England with the technology firm Palantir, citing concerns about its links to US defence and intelligence work. The Science, Innovation and Technology Committee says a reliance on a small number of US-based providers creates a potential vulnerability. Scientists studying the remains of Ötzi, the Iceman who died more than 5,000 years ago, say some of the ancient microbes in his body may still be alive. Tests are now needed to confirm whether the microscopic organisms they've identified are still viable, but researchers say it is possible, as some bacteria can remain dormant for thousands of years.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 25 to 8. At the start of this week, Donald Trump declared that all shooting will stop in Lebanon as he announced that both sides, Israel and Hezbollah, had told him that they had agreed to de-escalate. And this came after Iran appeared to threaten to pull out of ceasefire talks because of what was happening in Lebanon. Well, since then and overnight, there has been some continued fighting in the south of Lebanon. And yesterday, a Hezbollah spokesman told the BBC that there isn't a ceasefire agreement that they have agreed to. Mahmoud Kamati, who's a member of Hezbollah's political council, spoke to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. His words here are spoken by a producer.
As for what the Lebanese government is doing, we think these negotiations do not concern us, nor do we recognize their findings or decisions, because we have rejected them on principle. Maybe Trump was dreaming or imagining it. This matter did not happen at all. But as Trump's habit, he says something and then it's opposite and so on. So no, nothing happened.
Well, the Lebanese government has tried to make clear its anger and frustration, not just with Israel, whose troops now occupy a swathe of land in the south of the country, but also with Hezbollah for its ongoing provocation. Dr. Najat Aoun Saliba, who's an independent MP in the Lebanese parliament, told us what people there are facing right now in their day-to-day lives.
We have so many problems to deal with. First, the displaced. We have over 1 million people displaced, and these people are just looking for a place to live. And we were already living under very dire circumstances due to economic collapse and a continuous war that started since 2023. Hezbollah has said it over and over again, that they take orders from Iran. And that's very sad, because if they consider themselves Lebanese, I think they need to respect the constitution. They need to also, you know, discuss and obey by the law, the Lebanese law, and also work hand in hand with the institutions in order for us to save the country.
Well, let's speak to Jeremy Bowen, our international editor. Morning, Jeremy. How much of an impact does what is happening in Lebanon still have on those wider talks about trying to reach a ceasefire in Iran?
Well, in a way, it's the other way around, because the Iranians have been saying very consistently that Lebanon has to be part of the package. And also on the Gaza front, there's no chance of any progress there, I think, while these unfinished issues are being dealt with in the American-Iran relationship. I mean, my information is that the arrangement that was made with the Lebanese was actually not made by Hezbollah, but by someone who is very close to them, which is one of the people involved was the Speaker of the Lebanese Parliament, who is also a Shia, like Hezbollah, a guy called Nabi Bouri. And he's someone who was involved in all of that and in contact with Donald Trump. So while there is no ceasefire in Lebanon, effectively speaking, both sides are pulling in their horns a bit, not attacking Beirut and in return not attacking northern Israel. So I think that has actually taken away a potentially very large roadblock in the negotiations on this, what they're working on is this memorandum of understanding, which will allow them to go to, first of all, there'll be a deal to, if it goes through, a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. And then that will be followed by numbers of days are being discussed, but it's looking like at least 60 days to start with on those big issues like Iran's nuclear plans, what it does with its arsenals. Now, the fact is that Iran is in no particular mood to compromise on a lot of that kind of stuff. It might declare it doesn't want a nuclear weapon. That's not a problem for it. It's done many times in the past. But I think they're looking at trying to improve their overall strategic position in the region. And of course, for the Israelis, that's a big issue. And, bottom line on all of this, if Trump can show that he is trying to control what's going on in Lebanon, as far as Israel's behavior is concerned, then the very intense diplomacy that is going on will continue and will perhaps bear fruit. It is possible, but the things that we've been seeing, the various flare-ups in the Gulf, mean that both sides are signaling they are prepared to go back to war if necessary. The Iranians certainly. Of course, it's something. It's the last thing that Trump wants to do right now.
And Jeremy, I mean, look, you said that none of these things will be sorted quickly. There are more talks still to come. But in terms of those really key sticking points, things like Iran's nuclear program, things like who controls the Strait of Hormuz, are they obstacles which can eventually be negotiated on, do you think?
Well, the focus right now is reopening the Strait. That clearly is, the war has brought the world into an economic crisis, and potentially, if it continue to be closed into a global recession. And even if, you know, even Donald Trump's capacity to dismiss criticism, that's a pretty heavy one, because it also is affecting people in the United States, not least motorists who want to fill up their cars with petrol. So that's the significant factor at the moment. The other stuff, essentially what the MOU does, this memorandum of understanding, is to sort of defer some of those issues to what will be, have to be, a very lengthy negotiation. It's worth also, Anna, talking a little bit about Israel at the moment. Netanyahu really believes that he can remake the Middle East by using Israeli military power. And back on the 28th of February, this was going to be a major, the attack along with the Americans on Iran was going to be a major part of all of that. But it's not working out the way that he hoped, because Iran is becoming a full partner in these talks with the Americans. And when the US and the Israelis were expecting the regime to fall, it might emerge stronger than before. In Lebanon, the Israelis have been taken by surprise by the Hezbollah use of drones, which are steadily killing IDF soldiers. And Israel's dependence on the US has been exposed. Opposition leaders in Israel, of course, elections are coming up in, well, before October, are giving Netanyahu a very hard time about the fact that he said he'd attack Beirut and then he decided not to very quickly afterwards. And one of them said that Israel had become a vassal state. So there is a lot of stuff happening on different fronts in the region, which is remaking the region, but not in the way that Prime Minister Netanyahu was hoping.
Jeremy Bowen, our international editor. Thank you.
17 minutes to 8. Farewell then to Churchill, Austin, Turner and Turing from our banknotes, at least. In their place will be four animals or birds on our £5, £10, £20 and £50 notes. The Bank of England has released the shortlist of British wildlife that the public, you, will choose from. And you have a month to contribute your opinion to decide the future of those banknotes. It's worth saying the final decision won't be based entirely on a public vote, but here are the sounds of some of the 18 creatures to make that shortlist. We should have styled that as a quiz, really. Okay, so that was the common frog, the grey seal, barn owl, the puffin, the Eurasian curlew, Anna?
I got that one yet, yep. Straight away.
The bottlenose dolphin, just to be clear, a hedgehog, and the buff-tailed bumblebee. And one of those individuals who selected the shortlist is Katie Bell, also a senior conservation officer at Ulster Wildlife, who joins us now. Katie, good morning.
Good morning.
So it's a shortlist. I mean, but shortlist from presumably thousands of animals who potentially qualify for consideration.
Oh my goodness, what a hard decision we had. There are so many amazing species in the UK and we had to narrow it down. So yeah, it was not easy at all.
How on earth did you go from sort of the beautiful, vast panorama that is British wildlife to this shortlist?
Oh, it took a long time, a lot of negotiation, but it's so lovely to see. And we think we've got a great shortlist that really represents a lot of the diversity of British wildlife and also kind of represents a lot of the habitats. You know, we have everything from kind of marine to coastal to woodland to farmland. So yeah, we think we've done a good job, but there was also, you know, lots of criteria the Bank of England had around counterfeiting and design. So we kind of had to meet in the middle somewhere, and that's how we've ended up with this list.
Could you give us a sense of some of the animals that you had a soft spot for which didn't make the cut?
Oh goodness. Well, red squirrel has a soft place in my heart because I work on red squirrel conservation, and it features on the Scottish notes. So that's one species that we couldn't have because these notes had to be distinct. So that was a bit sad, but we got pine marten on there. So that is so exciting for me because pine marten, one of our amazing native woodland species. So that's great.
Okay, and just if people want to know about the others on the shortlist, obviously they can look it up online, it'll be on the Bank of England website, but just give us a flavour of some of them. So I mentioned mentioned the common frog, the grey seal, the barn owl, the puffin, the Eurasian curlew, the bottlenose dolphin, hedgehogs, buff-tailed bumblebees. You've mentioned the pine marten. Any others that people should be thinking about getting excited for?
I'd love to just shout out to the invertebrates on there and give our insects a bit of a shout because we've got an emperor dragonfly, amazing species, which would look so beautiful on there. The marsh fritillary butterfly, a species that the Wildlife Trust has been in loads of conservation work across the UK, and it's found in all four countries. And that was something we wanted to do as well. We wanted to make sure that people in all four corners of the UK would kind of resonate with these species. And some of them are more common than others. You know, you've got your hedgehog and your frog and your fox, which is amazing. Some of them people might not know as well, but we'd love people, you know, to look those up and then realize, oh, we have those here, I could go and see them. So that was the idea behind it all, you know.
Well, they can have a look on the Bank of England website and indeed get your recommendations. Katie, thank you very much indeed for your time. Katie Bell, conservation officer, senior conservation officer at Ulster Wildlife.
It's 13 minutes to 8. In just a moment, we'll speak to the UK boss of Palantir as MPs call for the tech giant's NHS contract to be cancelled over what they see as a clear mismatch with UK values. Before that, though, it's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Canon Angela Tilby.
Good morning. One of the clichés of the media industry is that the public have a right to know, especially when things go wrong. And it's often true. Think of the post office scandal or the recent investigations into some of our privatised water companies. It's important for the public to know when rules are being broken and when there's manifest injustice. But the right to know must be balanced by prudence. On issues of security or defence, or when vital decisions are pending, secrecy can be important. The whole point of a democratic system is that it's for us to choose who we trust, who we allow to keep secrets on our behalf. And all this is fine, of course, until it goes wrong. In recent days, many files relating to Peter Mandelson have been made public. We've learnt of indiscreet remarks between him and the then Work and Pensions Secretary, Pat McFadden. There are scathing comments about the Prime Minister and other leading politicians which were never meant to see the light of day, and come across now as disloyal. Reading them, I can't help but suspect part of this was simply letting off steam. Politicians have a right, as we all do, to trust that casual remarks, sometimes made in frustration, won't go any further. But of course they sometimes do, and in the days of smartphones this trust is coming to seem naive. Perhaps we could reflect on Jesus' prophecy that what you have said in the dark will be heard in the light, and what you have whispered in an inner chamber will be proclaimed on the housetops. This is very challenging. Who hasn't said something disparaging behind someone's back and then interacted with them as if they'd never spoken? Hypocrisy is part of the human condition, and Jesus himself warns against it. Let your yea be yea and your no be no. That leaves it up to us to make judgments about who we trust and why, who we can safely let off steam to and who it's best to avoid. The public's right to know has to be balanced by common sense, because in the case of secrecy, context is all. Another journalistic cliché, of course, but it's true. And perhaps we should extend our sympathy to those who carry the burden of secrecy on our behalf. Not everything is a plot. Not everything said in private actually matters that much, though its exposure can be deeply embarrassing. Jesus told his disciples to be as innocent as doves, but I don't think he was telling them to take everything at face value. In the same sentence, he had advised them to be as wise as serpents.
That was Thought for the Day with Canon Angela Tilby. It is 10 to 8.
In Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, there is an elvish language called Quenya, in which the word palan means far or distant, and tir is the verb for to look or to watch over. The Palantir were magical, far-sighted seeing stones, and Tolkien's universe has been a profound influence on Silicon Valley today. Palantir Technologies is a data and AI giant worth hundreds of billions of pounds, growing fast, with deep global influence and a highly opinionated boss. It's also deeply embedded in the modern British state, having done vital work during COVID. The company says that's because it is saving lives, money and time. But today, the Science, Innovation and Technology Committee of MPs says that while the company has been far-sighted, the British state has been myopic. They point to a, and I quote, mismatch with UK values, excessive dependence that amounts to a, again, quote, lock-in from which the British state won't be able to extract itself, and they want to end a £330 million NHS contract early. The committee doesn't question whether Palantir has achieved positive results, but it does ask if others could do the same at a better price and without the ideological baggage. Labour MP Dame Chi Onwuara chairs that committee.
One of the key barriers is around legacy systems and vendor locking, and Palantir is symptomatic of a dependency on a small number of US companies, which means that we haven't got the, means we're more likely to be locked in. So the key issue for us here is that when you have vendor locking, and particularly with a company like Palantir, which lacks public trust and lacks the trust of some of the NHS providers, when you have vendor locking, then you are always going to end up with worse services.
Well, we'll come back to those themes in just a moment. First, the union Unison, which represents NHS staff, is also concerned about the current possible future work of Palantir and what it's doing with the health service. Helga Pyle is Unison's head of health, and she spoke to us a couple of days ago.
There is a real concern about the ethical standards of companies such as that are, whose main business is surveillance, military involvement. I think you can see the level of concern that this has caused, and there's a really active debate about whether that contract should continue.
Well, Louis Mosley is the CEO of Palantir here in the UK and joins us in the studio. Mr. Mosley, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. The committee says that in its criticism that it's not ideologically motivated or driven by concerns about the quality of your products. They say it's about value for money and about British statecraft. What do you say to that?
Well, I'm glad that the committee welcomes and accepts that the programme is delivering for the NHS and that it's been very successful. But I think it's very concerning then that they're calling for it to be cancelled. And I think it's, frankly, irresponsible.
Well, there are two different kind of categories under which they're doing it. Let's do the ideology first. Let's take that head on. Your boss, Mr. Karp, is a vigorous proponent of Western civilization. He's a staunch defender of Israel. Palantir's work with the US Immigration Customs Enforcement to do the things which President Trump, who has a democratic mandate, wants. You've worked with the Pentagon on something called Project Maven, which is a battlefield exercise. You stepped in when Google exited after a staff revolt. If you put all of that together, there are some people listening to this, some people who are elected to Parliament, who might be horrified by all of that. Why shouldn't they say they don't want to work with you?
Well, what are the values of the NHS? It's delivering care to patients across Britain free at the point of delivery. That is what our software is helping NHS workers do day in, day out for the last 2 years.
But other things that your company does, people might take against. And there are lots of people who've boycotted companies for all sorts of reasons, for decades, for centuries. Isn't it reasonable for people to say we don't want to work with a company if it does other things elsewhere that they don't like?
Well, we do have red lines. We have never worked in China. We've never worked in Russia. We've never worked in any country that we would consider as adversarial to the West and to the West's values. However, we are committed to working in those countries that respect liberal democracy, that respect the rule of law, and where they have a democratic mandate. Perhaps the policy is very controversial. You mentioned, for example, President Trump's immigration policies and ICE enforcement. We do support them. But as you mentioned, he had a clear democratic mandate that was tested in 2024, that was given to him by the American public. And I, frankly, would not want to live in a world where self-appointed, unelected tech bosses can decide which government policies can actually be delivered and which can't.
Do you think corporate boycotts are always wrong in principle?
No, of course not. And I think there are
some people who might say Trump's got a mandate, but they think what you're doing with ICE or what ICE itself does or what Israel does or whatever it might be, other projects you do, Project Maven, they might look at that and say, that stuff's horrible. We don't want this company anywhere near our NHS.
Well, I think what people in this country, for the most part, value is, are those government services delivering? Our software has helped over the last 2 years the NHS to deliver 110,000 operations that would not otherwise have happened. It's helping people up and down the country. You mentioned Unison. There will be thousands of Unison members today who are using the software to deliver better patient care with less waste. Now, would those MPs look those constituents in the eye and tell them that because of the way a different government in a faraway country may be using the same software, they are going to have to accept that their operation is going to be delayed?
Well, the second half, and actually probably the weight of the committee report today, says that the British state is too dependent on one company. It's very interesting, because do you almost look at this and think, well, if you guys got a problem, why don't you get other people? Because it's quite a striking thing, isn't it? After you had that £1 contract in COVID as a sort of starting point, the British government has come to you again and again and again, and you've expanded, haven't you?
Well, and that is why I used the word, I think, irresponsible with respect to the committee report, because it proposes that the NHS cancel our contract, but it doesn't propose an alternative.
Is there an alternative?
Well, the NHS ran a competition that took almost 18 months, that was fully open and competitive, in which every tech company you can think of bid. It was 30 independent assessors that ran it. And at the end of that process, we were found to be the best company to deliver on the requirements that the NHS needed.
Is it also the case that there was an open competition for the £240 million enterprise agreement that you entered with the MOD?
So that was actually an extension of an existing contract. So that's a slightly different process. But the one that the committee is calling to be cancelled is the NHS one. And it was fully competed. And they established, the NHS did, that there was no alternative.
Do you accept that the British state is now so dependent on you that it's difficult to extract you from it?
No, I don't. And I think that's actually a technical misunderstanding. The British state has used us in two departments that have since stopped using us and had no issues with transferring the data, the logic, the intellectual property that they developed in our software out of our software and into other vendors. So this notion that we are
part of a lock-in,
of our vendor lock-in, is false.
But how do you reconcile that with the MOD's direct award notice, which explicitly said only Palantir can do a particular job for them without serious cost and disruption?
Well, that is a dependency which is different to a lock-in. If a competitor emerges that can do what we do or can do what we do better, then of course the MOD, I mean, as a citizen, I would want to make sure it gets its value for money and it can move to a different provider.
And if the British government wanted to stop using Palantir services tomorrow, how easy would it be to make that actually happen?
Well, as those two departments I mentioned, MHCLG and the Cabinet Office, have demonstrated over the past 2 years, it's doable and it's frankly quite trivial.
The committee says the British state must retain, I quote, retain the ability to pick and choose individual suppliers and safeguard against the risk of vendor lock-in and debilitating dependencies. Why would they say that unless there was a debilitating dependency on your company?
I mean, there is a dependency. I'm not going to deny that. With anything that works, one becomes dependent. You know, you are dependent on your car to get to work, but that doesn't stop you getting rid of that car and replacing it with a different one. This is a confusion of two different concepts.
Louis Mosey, CEO of Palantir UK, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
Things just swirling around my head. Am I really the product of this?
Astonishing secrets uncovered by at-home DNA tests.
Little did I know what more was to come.
I'm Jenny Kleeman, and in the new series of The Gift, we'll hear more stories emerging out of the ever-expanding global DNA database.
I did know that I was different.
You had kids together.
Yeah.
Then we met.
The Gift. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Just coming up to 8 o'clock, 1 minute to go, Simon King's got the weather.
Amal, thanks. Good morning. It's going to feel a little bit fresh, maybe even a bit cool for many of us today. We've got low pressure moving its way in, so that's going to bring some rain and some showers across England and Wales. That rain is already starting to work its way through Wales and southwest England. It will continue to push its way eastward. So after a dry start across eastern areas, we'll see that rain moving in by mid-morning, eventually clearing away into the North Sea. But behind that rain, as it moves eastward, we'll see some showers following, and those could be heavy, perhaps even a bit thundery, particularly around northern areas of England. Limited bright spells, breezy conditions, temperatures 16 to 20 degrees. For Northern Ireland, the rain is already with you. Pretty wet this morning. That rain is going to clear away to the northeast. There'll be some showers behind it. Rain also pushing its way through Scotland with showers following as well. Blustery conditions, temperatures 14 to 17 Celsius.
It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday, the 3rd of June. The headlines this morning. The Home Secretary has said clashes with police in Southampton last night were unacceptable and that the murder of Henry Novak is being hijacked for violence. Kuwait says its international airport has been badly damaged by Iranian drones as clashes between the US and Iran test the fragile ceasefire. Puffins, bumblebees and sharks are competing to appear on the new generation of British banknotes.
And coming up in the next hour of the programme, our political editor Chris Mason has been taking the temperature in Makerfield. He's coming up at 20 past eight. And do we underappreciate the illustrator? The world's biggest museum for illustration is opening in London this week in honour of Quentin Blake.
I first had a drawing published in Punch magazine in 1949, and I was 16 then. I started looking at how many books I'd illustrated, but when I got to 500, I gave up.
We will speak to Lauren Child of the Charlie and Lola series and much more besides about what makes great illustration. The BBC News is read by Lisa Costello.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has condemned disorder at a protest in Southampton about the police handling of the murder of Henry Novak, describing the scenes as completely unacceptable. The student was handcuffed and arrested after he was fatally stabbed last December because his killer, Vikram Digwa, had lied to police that he'd been racially attacked. Ms. Mahmood said there could be no justification for hijacking the tragedy to fuel violence and disorder. Our correspondent Tim Muffett reports.
Henry Novak's family had said they hoped his death would not create further division, hatred or tension. But there was plenty on display in Southampton yesterday evening. About 200 to 300 people gathered outside Southampton Police Station. They heard speeches by figures including the far-right activist Tommy Robinson, whose real name is Stephen Yaxley Lennon. The crowds chanted, "Justice for Henry." The crowd then moved away, about a mile and a half into the suburbs and close to the family home of Vikram Digwa, the killer of Henry Novak. Bins, some bricks and an e-scooter were thrown at police. While officers with riot shields and batons attempted to hold a line along a street. Posting on social media, the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, condemned those involved in the disturbances. She said there could be no justification for hijacking the tragedy of Henry Novak's death to stir up violence and disorder.
Police chiefs are re-examining anti-racism commitments which have come under renewed scrutiny following the murder of Henry Novak. The National Police Chiefs Council says it's listening to concerns raised by politicians and will make changes where needed. The director of the London Policing College, Palm Sandhu, told this programme the guidance was designed to help officers better understand different cultures.
It doesn't say you treat people differently. It says take into account different cultures. Because if you're dealing with somebody who's deaf, blind, because it doesn't just cater for skin colour, what is the point of either shouting louder or showing them something that's written down? The race guidance has been used to politicalise what has happened in this tragedy.
Kuwait says an Iranian drone and missile strike has caused severe damage at its international airport, forcing flights to be suspended and diverted. The attack comes amid a further escalation in exchanges between US and Iranian forces, which are testing an already fragile ceasefire. From Jerusalem, our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell has the latest.
The attack on Kuwait caused severe damage to the airport's terminal building, the Kuwaiti Civil Aviation Authority says. Flights have been suspended until further notice. The latest exchange of fire between the US and Iran appears to have begun when US forces fired at an empty tanker trying to break through their naval blockade of Iranian ports. US Central Command says it also conducted strikes on Keshem Island in the Strait of Hormuz in response to attempted attacks by Iran. Iran retaliated by firing missiles at Kuwait and Bahrain, US regional allies where it has military bases. But the US said earlier these had fallen short or were intercepted.
Russia says its air defences have been responding to a Ukrainian drone attack on the area around St. Petersburg, which is hosting an international conference. The regional governor said 50 drones have been intercepted. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports from St. Petersburg.
During the night, the governor of Leningrad region had issued an air raid warning. Early this morning, he announced that 50 drones had been shot down around St. Petersburg. Plumes of thick black smoke are clearly visible in the sky here. The drone attack came just hours before the opening of the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, a major set-piece event that Russia uses to try to promote itself on the world stage. President Putin is due in St. Petersburg later this week to deliver a keynote address. Earlier, local officials said that security had been tightened in the city ahead of the event.
Microsoft says it's developed a quantum computing chip which is 1,000 times more reliable than its predecessor. It says the chip, Majorana 2, brings commercially viable quantum computers a step closer. The firm says the improvement is comparable to moving from a mobile phone that needs charging every day to one that only needs charging every few years. A committee of MPs wants the government to end its NHS data contract in England with the tech giant Palantir. The company has deep links in US defence and security, and the Science, Innovation and Technology Committee has said there's a clear mismatch with UK values. The Labour MP Dame Chi Omworis chairs the committee. She told us there were significant concerns about the firm's ethos.
A company with an ideological and political mission is a double risk, and particularly in the critical infrastructure. And this is the key point of our report. It is up to the state to have the right building blocks in place, and that includes the right skills within the state. It includes the right knowing where how we're spending the $25 billion that we spend on digital, which isn't being tracked and monitored.
The Palantir contract includes work on the management of hospital waiting lists, and the government says it's speeding up diagnoses and treatment. Louis Mosley, the head of Palantir in the UK and Europe, told us the MPs are wrong on this one.
Our software has helped over the last 2 years the NHS to deliver 110,000 operations that would not otherwise have happened. There will be thousands of Unison members today who are using the software to deliver better patient care with less waste. Would those MPs look those constituents in the eye and tell them, because of the way a different government in a faraway country may be using the same software, they are going to have to accept that their operation is going to be delayed?
A woman who alleges she was trafficked to Mohammed Al-Fayed and raped by one of his business associates says she's furious after the Metropolitan Police sent her personal details to the wrong person. The BBC understands the force has been referred to the Information Commissioner over the data breach. More than 200 survivors of the former Harrods owner, who died in 2023, are expected to have a virtual meeting with the Prime Minister this afternoon. Ellie Price reports.
Joanna Britton, who spoke to the BBC after waiving her lifelong right to anonymity, described the Met as shambolic, incompetent and complicit. She gave a statement to Devon and Cornwall Police in 2017, which was then transferred to the Met. It detailed how she was trafficked to the former Harrods owner and was raped by one of his business associates. She later discovered the Met had sent handwritten notes of her account, as well as her address, contact number and date of birth, to another victim who lived in Australia, in error. The force would not comment on Miss Britton's case, but said its teams had transformed the way they investigated rape and sexual offences.
Scientists studying the remains of Ötzi, the Iceman who died more than 5,000 years ago, say some of the ancient microbes inside his body may still be alive. Tests are needed to confirm whether the microscopic life they've identified is still viable, but researchers say it's possible because some bacteria can remain dormant for thousands of years. Dr. Pontus Skoglund, a specialist in ancient DNA at the Francis Crick Institute, told us the body was extraordinarily well preserved.
So much soft tissue preserved, and that makes researchers able to access the DNA of his gut and look at this gut microbiome that he had, and they see that it matches what they call a non-westernized diet, one that doesn't have as much ultra-processed food and other things. The Iceman didn't die from an infection, so he died from being shot in the back, basically, murdered potentially.
The Bank of England is asking the public to choose which animals and birds should appear on the next generation of banknotes. From today, people have a month to pick their favourites from a shortlist, with wildlife set to replace the historical figures featured on 5, 10, 20 and 50 pound notes for more than half a century. But as our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey reports, the final lineup won't be decided by a public vote alone.
The rich mix of Britain's wildlife is made clear because the bank's shortlist is not very short. 18 mammals, birds, amphibians, insects and fish have been nominated by an expert panel. The colourful kingfisher and common frog have an equal billing in this beauty contest, alongside creatures great and small, from basking sharks to butterflies. Puffins, pine martins, the buff-tailed bumblebee and the red fox are among others in contention. The public will be able to vote for up to six creatures they'd like to see on future banknotes, influencing but not determining the Bank of England governor's final choice. And to avoid Stoaty McStoatface type jokes, no alternative nominations will be accepted.
Kevin Peachey reporting.
Thank you, Lisa. It's 10 minutes past eight. the appalling death of Henry Novak, arrested and handcuffed as he lay dying from a knife attack in the street in Southampton, has raised serious and structural questions for policing in this country. His murder has also created outrage, as seen at protests in the city last night when demonstrators hurled missiles at officers trying to restore order. Shabana Mahmood, the Home Secretary, has called those scenes completely unacceptable. The spark that has lit the tinderbox here is race. Were Henry's desperate pleas for help ignored because he'd been accused baselessly of a racist attack? How much of that was driven by bad, careless policing, by a lack of curiosity by those officers at the scene, or by policy? Well, in theory, some of those questions should be answered by the Independent Office for Police Conduct's report, which has already begun and we're told will conclude as soon as possible. But while we wait for that, the speculation continues. Reform UK's Home Affairs spokesperson Zia Yusuf spoke to The World at One yesterday. He said a raft of measures would be needed to prevent another such case.
We need a whole host of things to happen. So number one, straight off the bat, we can take away religious exemptions for anybody in this country who is not law enforcement to carry deadly weapons around. So that one, straightforward, we've already committed to that. Number two, we will be announcing a raft of new measures to remove all of this, quote, anti-racism, which effectively creates racism against white people from policing in this country. We need one law for everybody. And the fact we can never again live in a country, and we must not live in a country, where the accusation of racism is taken more seriously than the accusation of brutal murder.
In an interview with Newsnight, the Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch suggested that police anti-racism training had gone too far.
They are trying to deal with a legacy of them being called institutionally racist when they're not institutionally racist anymore. If anything, they have overcorrected. I want to see people treated equally, doesn't matter what skin colour they are. And that didn't seem to happen in this case.
And amid the recriminations and the rhetoric, there is a wider concern as well. Do violent street protests mean that we've already lost sight of the powerful words that Henry's father, Mark Novak, spoke outside court after his son's murderer was sentenced on Monday, when he said, "We do not want Henry's death to be used to create further division, hatred or tension." Well, joining us is Sarah Jones, the Minister for Policing and Crime. Good morning.
Morning.
We heard from various of your political colleagues there. Do you think at the moment that policing in this country is getting it right on racism?
Well, of course, everybody is equal under the law. That is the foundation on which our policing operates. It's the foundation on which our society operates. It's what enables us to have a tolerant and inclusive society. And that must always be the case. Now, those of us who have watched, as many of us have, the horrific video of the last moments of Henry Novak's life, quite rightly questioning what on earth happened in that situation. How was it possible that he was handcuffed when he was mortally, seriously about to die, and his dying breaths were when he was essentially in custody? It's too horrific to contemplate. And so, of course, it's right that we're asking questions, and it's right that we get answers. And the IOPC, as you said, are investigating. They will look at the whole footage of what happened. They will speak to the officers, to the family, to everybody, to get to the bottom of that. But the police have a sacred duty to treat everyone equally under the law, and we will always make sure that that is the case.
Mm. You've said more than once there about everybody being equal under the law, but the National Police Chiefs Council anti-racism commitment, which we know already is being looked at again, it says our commitment to racial equity means producing equality of policing outcomes for people from different ethnic groups. It also says it does not mean treating everyone the same or being colourblind, brackets racial equality. So it actively says that they are not treating people equally in this case. When it says producing equality of policing outcomes, what is your understanding of what that means?
As I said, everyone should be treated equally under the law, and I think it's right that they are reviewing this document and looking at the language. This particular document is a sort of values document. It's quite a short document, and I don't think it forms the basis of any training or any police activity.
But it is an official document.
It is an official National Police Chiefs Council document, yes, and it is being reviewed. We think the language is wrong. It gives the wrong impression. But I don't think it affects how our training is done. But look, of course, people are right to ask questions when they've seen such a horrific incident, and we will be listening and learning the lessons. There is a history, as you said, of racism within policing that forms an important part of the policing picture when you are trained, but you are also trained, as you said, on, you know, how you run into danger, how you make split-second decisions based on everyone being equal, based on safety as being the first priority that you have as a police officer. You have to assess the scene, you have to understand, you have to be curious, as you said, you have to problem solve, all in a very short and high tension often situation.
And we didn't see any of that in this case. We didn't see the scene being properly assessed, and we certainly didn't see curiosity.
No, you're right.
So that document that we were talking about then, you are under the firm belief that needs to change, and change pretty quickly.
Yes.
And when we talk about producing equality of policing outcomes and about not treating everyone the same, you think that needs to go entirely?
I think that document is being reviewed, and the MPCC have said that they are reviewing that. The basis of the Police Action Plan, which is a much wider piece of work that was introduced under the last government, is founded on the sort of knowledge that the black community have less trust in policing than any other community in the country, that they are underrepresented in the police workforce, and that they are overrepresented when it comes to the use of police force. That is an important thing to acknowledge and respond to. That is not the same as saying everybody shouldn't be treated equally, because of course they should.
Do you feel that you can say today, here this morning, with confidence that there is no two-tier policing in this country?
I would say that the principles, as we've said, are important, that everyone is equal under the law. I would say that there are 100,999 calls a day, and that in the majority of cases, the police are doing the right thing, making the right decisions in the right way. But I would also say that wherever there are mistakes, and this is a case where the country is looking to us to make sure we learn the lessons and put anything wrong right, that we continue to strive to do that. But the principles of what our policing by consent foundations are based on, equality under the law, that is the basis of our entire society.
But I think you agree at times that we do see examples of two-tier policing.
I think we see examples of people making the wrong call in different ways. In the main, that is not what we see. I think to push a certain sort of agenda in this case is not helpful. We have to wait and see what the IOPC says. And we have to, as you very powerfully said at the beginning, we have to listen to what the family have told us, which is now is not a time for knee-jerk reactions. It's not a time for raising tensions or hatred. It is a time in his memory of putting things right and tackling the epidemic of knife crime, which is so important in this country.
When you look at that body camera footage and you look at what happened in this case and its outcome, do you think that anti-white racism was a factor in this case?
I look at that footage, and as a mother, I find it almost impossible to see. I think everybody does. I think everybody can't understand what the response was. I think everybody has a degree of anger about it because it looks so wrong. But I think we have to step back and allow the IOPC to do its investigation. And we have to, and this government's commitment is that whatever the IOPC says, there will be consequences to that, there will be action from that. And of course, this is a moment for us all in government to go, what are we doing? Are we making sure through our very, very comprehensive police reform agenda that we are embarking on, that we are looking at training, looking at all these issues really carefully to make sure we get the best police officers trained in the best way to keep our people safe?
Are those officers who arrested Henry Novak as he lay dying, who handcuffed him, who told him that he hadn't been stabbed, are they still on frontline duty?
The IOPC is dealing with that situation, so I'm not going to say.
Do you know the answer?
I do.
If they were on frontline duty, would that be appropriate?
We've had a case of one officer who's been misidentified as being one of the officers who was involved in this case, who has had to move home with his family because of the death threats and the risk to him and his life.
And that is appalling for him. But this is a separate issue. Those officers who displayed what was a clear dereliction of duty that night, if they are still on frontline duty, is that appropriate?
I know where the officers are, in the sense of, I'm talking to the police chief constable and the police and crime commissioner. The IOPC is doing an investigation. It wouldn't be right for me to be publicly saying where they are or where they are.
No, I'm not asking you whether, I'm saying, would it be appropriate if they were still on frontline duty?
Well, the technical situation in terms of the IOPC is that they have, for the purposes of their investigation at the moment, been treated as witnesses, which is the sort of criteria that they are in at the moment. They will have been witnesses in the trial that has just finished. The IOPC now are doing their investigation. Whatever needs to happen in terms of consequences, in terms of whether there is misconduct, gross misconduct, that is for the IOPC to decide and to rule on. It's not for me and it's not for the police chief either.
So you would feel happy that the public would be safe and would be treated fairly and appropriately if they were involved in an incident which one of those officers attended?
Look, as the policing minister, of course, people will have views on this and you will know what they are likely to be. As policing minister, we have to let the IOPC do their job, and it's not right for me to be saying where they're working or where they're not working at this time.
Sarah Jones, the Minister for Policing and Crime. Thank you.
Thank you.
23 minutes past eight. Well, it's worth perhaps repeating the words of Henry Novak's father, Mark Novak, who said outside court, "We want to use Henry's heartbreaking story to make change for the better. We do not want his death to be used to create further division, hatred or tension." But of course, in the context of the Makerfield by-election, which is informing politics in a very big way at the moment, that is proving hard to keep to. It's worth saying that overnight, Reform UK put out an advert or a post on social media saying Kemi Badenoch, just like Starmer, doesn't care. Only Reform UK will openly say that white lives matter too. They quote, as they put it, Kemi Badenoch saying in 2020, black lives do matter. And then in 2026 saying, I don't want to hear about white lives matter. Of course, the Conservatives have responded furiously to this, saying that it's a complete misrepresentation of what Kemi Badenoch said in both instances, and it's taken her words out of context. Politics is intruding on this in a very big way. Chris Mason is our political editor and joins us now. Chris, just tell us about how the context of Makerfield, where I know you've been spending a lot of time, is informing the reaction to the Henry Novak case.
Yeah, the backdrop, Amal, to the by-election is the conversation that Anna and the minister were just having there, multiplied a millionfold or more because of the conversations that what we've been reporting in the last few days, how they're being reflected on in homes around the country. So clearly the tone and the tenor of the reflections, the commentary, was always likely to be fraught, wasn't it, given the nature of what's being discussed. But I think it's probably magnified in the context of the by-election. There has, as you say, been a furious response to this Reform social media post, the critics of Reform saying that they wildly took Kemi Badenoch out of context because she had said, I don't want to hear about Black Lives Matter, I don't want to hear about White Lives Matter. Everyone matters, but as you were quoting there, the quote that Reform chose was just that sentence about, I don't want to hear about white lives matter. Reform this morning are defiant. They say they quoted an entire sentence and they are standing by what they have posted. The context of the by-election is one where Labour and Reform are very aware of how this is playing out in the constituency. There's also Restore Britain. That's the outfit of the former Reform MP Rupert Lowe. Mr Lowe has accused Reform of vindictively weaponising the death. And there is a sense from the campaigns and on the ground in the patch that Restore might be eating into Reform's vote in Makerfield.
There is just a sense, isn't there, as well, Chris, that we live in a media environment where just the fact that we're merely talking about that advert will be seen by some people as a win, because the aim is to create noise, isn't it? You're spending a lot of time in that the by-election patch of Makerfield, and I know you've been speaking to Reform's candidate Robert Kenyon too, Chris.
Yeah, so this is a patch that is broadly in a semicircle to the south of Wigan, places like Ashton and Makerfield, Plattbridge, Winstanley, Hindley, Orrell, Westleigh. It's been a Labour stronghold in Westminster elections since pretty much the dawn of time. Right now, you can really feel how competitive it is. Reform did very well in the local elections last month. Yesterday, I was at a pub called Chapo's in Ashton, was talking to Robert Kenyon. He's a plumber, recently elected local councillor. He's got a resolutely local pitch to the electorate there. He has quite the back catalogue of online commentary, which has been part of the story of this by-election. And he offered to me this partial defence of online remarks about Carol Vorderman.
I've not made sexual remarks about Carol Vorderman. Somebody else did, but then I responded with a crass joke about that comment, so I personally didn't make the comment.
Carol Vorderman said what you'd said was disgusting. There's a pattern around some of the remarks you've said in the past that have sounded like they were degrading women.
There might have been a few crass comments. You know, if I'm as an elected public official, which I am now, I wouldn't make any crass comments, because everything you do say is under a microscope, but comments that are made before I was involved in politics, you know, you'll be judged in the future by what you say.
And when you were last in Makerfield, Chris, you also heard from Andy Burnham. It's interesting looking at his campaign literature and videos that there is this sort of unashamedly national message rather than just merely a local one.
Yeah, because he's making this double pitch, isn't he? He is in very keen, obviously, to emphasise to people locally his local roots, which are real, but it is also visible from the moon what his wider ambition is. And what's so interesting, Amol, is that this is a test case in his entire political proposition, that he can change Labour. In other words, that he can make it competitive against Reform again. And so this is a contest that matters hugely to both parties, Labour and Reform. But there is still an asymmetry. It matters more to Labour, because if they, with Andy Burnham, can't win in somewhere like Makerfield, well, where can they win? And with who can they win? Now, I hear a very carefully articulated hope privately from Labour folk that they think at the moment they probably have the numbers from their canvass returns, but that there's a sense that some of the vote is soft and that there's a sticky element of the vote, perhaps into the teens as a proportion, that is not committing yet. And obviously there's still a fortnight to go. When I was talking to Mr Burnham, I put it to him, this quote that follows him around pretty much everywhere he goes. It was the remarks he made to the New Statesman magazine last autumn, where he said, "We've got to get beyond this thing of being in hock to the bond markets."
I have never said ignore the bond markets. That wasn't what I was saying. It was a political attack.
And it was on your own side.
Manipulated
Chancellor
for
was
that purpose. I was saying that politicians have left the country in that position, because we gave up control of large swathes of the economy. For instance, housing, the public housing stock shrunk hugely. And why is that an issue? Because you lose control of the benefits spend, because you're chasing rents through the benefit system in the private... In the private rented sector. So my argument is, we gave up control of public spending.
And yes, he is seeking to reassure on that point, saying that he would stick to the government's borrowing limits, its so-called fiscal rules. I should say, Amol, that postal votes will be dropping in the next day or two in the constituency at polling day 2 weeks tomorrow.
Chris, thank you very much indeed, as ever. And you can find a full list of the candidates standing in the Makerfield by-election on the BBC News website.
It's 8:30. It's time for the sport. Here's Mike.
Anna, thank you. Going to try something different this hour. Illustrations on the radio. I know we are marking Quentin Blake's birthday before the end of the programme, but before that, wanted to also celebrate arguably the UK's greatest sporting illustrator. Paul Trevelyan has been drawing the world's biggest sports stars for over 7 decades. His pictures have featured everywhere from Roy of the Rovers to The Observer's long-running You Are the Ref feature. Well, Paul is now 92 years old, and he has a new illustrative book out all about the history of the World Cup. And I sat down with him recently, and he started by telling me about how his two loves of football and drawing first collided.
I was born in 1934. I was born in White Hart Lane, Tottenham, which is a 2-minute walk to the Tottenham Hotspur football ground. In 1950, I think, England got involved with the World Cup, and they had 3 Tottenham players: Dishburn, Nicholson and Ramsey. And from that moment on, I've always followed the World Cup.
For the world of English soccer, 1950 poses a straight question. A picked team of those players met defeat in the World Cup almost as soon as it landed in Brazil. What went wrong in Rio?
I decided that I was going to draw footballers in 1937 when I saw Dixie Dean.
How old were you then?
How old was I then? I was 3. My father was a bus conductor. He changed his shift. It was a cup replay. It was on a Wednesday. And I left that ground and I said to my dad, I said, Dad, I'm going to draw footballers. And he said, what do you mean draw footballers? I said, I'm going to draw them. I'd scribbled a few, the dog and the cat and that. But this time, I really did want to become a football artist.
When you look back on your body of work, of all the characters in the whole of world football over the last 6-7 decades, who have you enjoyed drawing the most?
Pele.
In the middle, here's Pele, number 10. Rivellino, watch Pele now. What a beautiful goal for Pele. El Rey Pele. 100 goals for Brazil in World Cup competitions, and Brazil take this 1-0 lead.
I love drawing Pele so much that I went to Stanley Pauls and they said, we've published the book King Pele, and every drawing in that book was mine. I went to a signing session for the book, and sitting next to me was Pele, and he looked through it and he said, give me your name. And I gave him my name. He said, give me your address. I gave him my address. And from that moment on, every time Pele got a job which required art, I was the man. He was the man who phoned me up and said, come for the World Cup 94. I went there and worked with Umbro. That was for Pele. See, I learnt my lessons not from art teachers, but from players who have told me what I was doing wrong, why I hadn't captured that person completely. I had to work at it and work at it and work at it.
And can I ask you about the future of sport illustrations? You grew up in an era of the printing press, when newspapers and magazines and comics, I guess, were king. Now, in the digital age, pictures can be drawn on iPads, on iPhones, on tablets. Do you fear for the future of sports illustration now that we are in a digital age?
No, because an artist, if he's really good, really knows his craft, he will always be in demand. People say, can you draw this? Can you draw that? Can you draw my dad standing next to Lewis Hamilton? He's never met him, but I wanted to give him that for Christmas. And I get incredible commissions. And like every other artist, if he can really draw, you'll always be in demand.
And you are still drawing now into your 90s? Do you enjoy drawing? Look, is there a release for you?
Look at that hand. Look at that hand.
It's very straight.
Look at it.
Very straight.
That hand doesn't shake, not one bit. And I do eye exercises. I look at my hand and I look at something 200 yards away. I look at my hand. I do that 3 times a day. My eyes are sharper than the average Premiership referee. I promise you that.
It's nodded in by Kane! Harry's done it for St George. He's won the opening match for England.
Who do you enjoy drawing from the current England squad?
Harry Kane.
He's a North London boy.
That's it.
Just like you.
I've drawn him.
He's the captain of England.
Mm-hmm.
And in a few weeks' time, he may well have the World Cup in his hands. Would that be a fitting last portrait for you?
If Harry Kane wins the World Cup, you pick up the newspaper. I'll be in one.
Your picture.
It will be in a paper. I promise you that. It'll be in a newspaper.
Well, we look forward to seeing it for everybody's sake. Thank you so much for speaking to us on the programme.
God bless.
It's been pointed out to me, not least by my Welsh producer, that not everybody wants England to win the World Cup. But for Paul Trevelyan's sake, we hope to see his pictures during the tournament this summer. What a character.
An exquisite voice, exquisite accent. And this book is one of the most amazing books I've seen for a very long time. A history of the World Cup on the pitch and off the drawing board. And the pictures are just incredible.
Yeah, with words from the journalist Harry Harris as well. It is out now.
Fantastic. Mike, thank you so much. What an extraordinary interview. What an extraordinary man. Here's Tim Harford with a look at this morning's More or Less.
It's been claimed that migrants will get half of all new homes, but we think that's not how it works. The numbers, as so often, will bring some clarity. We examine the moron premium in the bond market. Or in plain language, why does it cost the government so much to borrow money and who should we blame? And what does the evidence suggest about reading standards in Welsh primary schools? That's More or Less with me, Tim Harford, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds in half an hour.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Amol Rajan and Anna Foster. And at 24 minutes to 9, Lisa Costello has a summary of the news.
The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, has said disorder at a protest in Southampton about the police handling of Henry Novak's murder was completely unacceptable. Two people were arrested. Police chiefs are re-examining anti-racism commitments, which have come under renewed scrutiny because Henry Novak was arrested after he was stabbed. His killer had made a false claim that he had been the victim of a racist attack. The policing minister, Sarah Jones, told this programme she believed officers had a sacred duty to treat everyone equally under the law and that the language in the anti-racism document risks giving the wrong impression. She said it was right the wording is now being reviewed. Kuwait says a terminal building at its international airport has been hit by Iranian drones. Officials say several people were hurt and flights have had to be suspended or diverted. US and Iranian forces have exchanged fire overnight, again testing the fragile ceasefire.
Lisa, thank you very much indeed. It's 23 minutes to 9. In the past half hour or so, the OECD, that's the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, has published its latest economic forecast, including for Britain, and it's not a cheery outlook. Sluggish growth, owing in part to, as ever, poor productivity, inflation staying above target. No great revelation, just frankly a rather prevailing atmosphere of gloom. And it's worth saying that Britain is not at all unique in this regard. Many other European countries obviously also have a similarly soft outlook. Let's speak to Sir Howard Davies, chairman of the Phoenix Group, chairman of NatWest until 2024, former chairman of the Financial Services Authority and director of the London School of Economics. Former director, I should say, Sir Howard. Sir Howard, good morning.
Good morning.
What's your initial reading, if you've had a chance to look, of this OECD reading of our economy?
I think you have to look at what it's based on, and it's based on an assumption that the conflict in the Middle East will fairly soon come to an end. And on that basis, the UK looks as if it trundles along, exactly as you said, at a relatively low level of growth, but actually more or less in line with the rest of Europe. There are some particular factors in the UK. Lower migration is slowing growth, lower inward migration, and the failure to reform the planning system is something that's actually highlighted by the OECD. But the big problem is that it is based on an assumption that the Middle Eastern conflict will end soon. And if not, then you'd have to say all bets are off.
What is the mechanism by which lower inward migration has a net negative effect on growth?
Most of the migrants, and I'm disregarding the illegal migrants, who, of course, sure, are not allowed to work unless they get regularised, but most of the migrants come here for a job. And so on average, the proportion of them who are working is higher than the average for the population as a whole. They're not particularly on benefits because they typically come for a job now. So they are just reducing the size of the employed workforce. So it's the whole GDP. It is perhaps slightly different when you talk about GDP per head, because it's simply growing the whole size of the cake. But of course, it's divided by among a slightly larger number of people.
Inflation hurts poor people the most because they spend more of any income they have, disposable income, on things like food and energy. And we're about to possibly import quite a bit of energy inflation. Does Britain's energy policy make it unusually exposed, Sir Howard, including in terms of inflation, to the events in the Straits of Hormuz?
Yes, we are more exposed than, say, the French, who have a large proportion of nuclear power in their energy mix. And the OECD do say that we should be accelerating investment in our electricity networks, which in fact will allow more renewables to come into the system. So they do highlight that. But actually, on this latest review, that doesn't feature as a very prominent impact. And our inflation rate does fall, according to them, from 3.7 by the end of this year down to 2.4 in 2027. So I would say that that factor seems now to be influencing economists somewhat less than it was a few months ago.
Okay, final thought. I don't know if you had the pleasure of listening to our political editor, Chris Mason, talk to Andy Burnham about what he said or didn't say about the bond markets. He thinks he was misrepresented. He never said that the UK has been too excessively in hock to bond markets. He said it's more about public finances. Just in broad terms, how should our listeners be thinking about bond markets and whether or not they do exercise a necessary discipline? You know, they're not a bunch of unruly, you know, kids who've been watching too many cartoons. I mean, yeah. Bond markets are institutional investors. They're real people, and bonds are debt instruments. How should we be thinking about the relationship between bond markets and politics?
Well, I think it's in one sense pretty simple for people to understand, because if you are, as an individual, borrowing from a bank, whether it's in the form of a large mortgage or a large overdraft, then you are influenced by the policies of that bank. The bank will be watching your finances rather more closely than they would if you weren't borrowing from them. And if your spending seems to get out of hand, the bank will want to know why that is happening. It's very similar. We are in a position where we are borrowing a large amount, and particularly in our case, we're borrowing from international investors who have a choice. Places like Japan tend to borrow purely domestically. Their domestic citizens invest in government bonds, and that's not the case here. We have to borrow internationally, and those international investors have got a choice. And if they think that the UK's finances is not under control, then they will charge us more, just in the same way as the bank would put up your overdraft charges if they thought that you were overspending your generous BBC salary.
So Howard Davies, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
It is 18 minutes to nine now. We were hearing earlier on the programme about the latest on SpaceX going public on the US stock market with its AI business at the core of that offer. Anthropic is doing the same, both of them looking towards a $1 trillion valuation. But the power of these companies and the fact that there's so few of them does raise the question of whether there is a crisis of control in AI. And that was the question for our Today debate last night. So here's a little flavour of it. This was Stuart Russell, Professor of Computer Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and Dame Wendy Hall, Regius Professor of Computer Science at the University of Southampton, on whether AI should make us scared.
Unless governments take their responsibility to protect people seriously and listen to what the companies are telling them about the lack of control over AI systems, but, you know, particularly as they become more and more capable, then we could get to a situation where, as one of the CEOs told me, Chernobyl will look like the best case scenario.
Mm. Wendy, what do you think?
This is all done because of market forces. These people are just not responsible. Right? They talk about being responsible about their products, and why are we driving towards something that could lead to the extinction of the human race? I think there will be resistance movements to it, because we're not just going to sit back and accept that, are we, as a society?
The impact of an AI revolution on jobs is another major concern for people. And Kate Bell from the Trades Union Congress and Nigel Toon, who's the founder of AI chip firm Graphcore, discussed how central employees in particular should be when businesses start using AI in the workplace.
It's not just important for workers to understand what the AI is doing, to understand when they have the right to challenge it. But if we want technology adoption in the UK, and technology adoption has been a problem across the UK economy, it is much, much more effective when workers have a say.
Okay.
You know, we've all had at some point in our careers an AI IT system implemented in our workplace that just doesn't work. And you think, if anyone, someone had told me they were going to do this, I could have said, oh, well, you know that's not going to work because none of us do our jobs like that. We've adapted. And I think actually the same is going to be true of AI. So if we want it adopted, if we want it used to boost productivity, not just to cut jobs, we need workers to have actually that say in how it's adopted, how it's used, and ultimately who benefits as well.
Nigel, how does that sound to you as an employer? Can you get on board with that?
I think it's really difficult. You need to be careful. So, for example, there are some banks, JP Morgan, for example, which is adopting AI very aggressively, and their business is doing very well, and they're hiring people. So you need to be careful that you don't introduce something that ends up making your business globally uncompetitive, and you might have a great environment, but you don't have a business anymore. And I'm not against the idea that, you know, we should have agency, we should have the ability for people to decide how this technology is used. And it comes back to what we were talking about before in terms of the control in the hands of a few, because if the technology is closed and those are the only companies that can drive the innovation, then how do you get agency for the employees to actually show how they can apply AI, they can use it better?
Well, you can listen back to the whole thing if you missed any of it. It's on BBC Sounds. Just search for the Today debate, or you can hear it here on Radio 4 after the news at 11 o'clock this morning. But let's continue with some of those themes. Cory Doctorow is with us, journalist, author of many books on the internet age. Most recently, the critically acclaimed Enshittification, Why Everything Suddenly Got Worse and What to Do About It. Cory, good morning.
Good morning.
We could spend the whole of the rest of the day talking about AI. So sometimes we need focus.
Which must we?
Yeah, we must. We must. Well, we decided to focus on this idea of a crisis of control. Do you think that there is one?
I think AI is the money-losingest thing the human race has ever done. I think it's grossly oversold. And I think that the capital markets have lost their minds because of the confluence of large tech monopolies that have saturated their markets and need to convince investors that they can keep growing despite the fact that they have 90% market shares. And the fact that they have a large customer base of bosses who are just infinitely excited at the prospect of firing mouthy workers who know how to do things that they don't know how to do and replacing them with software that compliantly does whatever that's told.
Mm. So you think there's a bit of a sense of the emperor's new clothes about it? We're being sold something that's not necessarily what we're getting.
Well, I don't think we have a bit of a sense. I think we have the largest sense in my memory of tech bubbles, which goes back to the first PC bubble. The fact that an AI salesman can convince your boss to fire you and replace you with a chatbot that can't do your job is a problem for employment, but it is not the same problem as the chatbot can do your job. We use chatbots to do jobs that we don't care if they're done well. Right? Bosses who don't like their reporters fire the reporters and replace them with chatbots that make things up. Bosses that see customer service as a cost center fire their customer service reps and replace them with chatbots that don't solve your problems. It's, you know, a natural progression. If you're going to hire a bunch of people in the Pacific Rim who are smart and capable, but then not let them exercise any judgment and have them follow scripts, why wouldn't you fire them and replace them with a chatbot? It's not like they're there to solve your problems. They're just accountability sinks.
That bit of history that you brought up there, the bursting of tech bubbles, reminded me that that's something that happens, doesn't it? What do you think might be the potential end of this one? Or do you think we're not there with it yet? Do you think it's going to continue for a while before we realize what you're saying?
Well, it's such a house of cards. I mean, we have these tech firms, as you say, that have these imminent flotations, and they're trying to clean up their balance sheets by hiking prices on their customers. And this is prompting customers who, just a few months ago, were telling workers, unless you find 11 things to do with AI, we're going to withhold a promotion or fire you, are now telling their workers, please stop using the AI because we're being charged not the price of the AI, but a fraction of the price of the AI, instead of being given thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars per worker subsidy by AI investors. So, you know, as they try to clean up their balance sheets and hike rates, you are now seeing the narrative change over to, you know, people who run very large tech-oriented firms like Uber saying, I don't know why we brought AI in, and I don't think we can keep using it at this price.
If you were, and I'm sure this idea will horrify you, but if you were a government, Cory, because ultimately it's them that we look to try and sort these things out, protect us, exert control where we think control needs to be exerted, what would you be doing right now?
Oh, well, I mean, buying AI at the top of the market is the most ridiculous thing I can imagine. We can see that there's a time on the horizon when you can buy GPUs at 10p in the pound, hire as many, you know, unemployed applied statisticians as you'd like at knockdown rates, and use open source models that will still be kicking around long after the firms that release them have been vaporized to do the useful things that AI can do, because it's just a normal technology. It does useful things. If I wanted to do some growth here, I would ignore all of that, not buy the asset at its most expensive, and instead do something like repeal Article 6 of the Copyright Directive that makes it illegal for British firms to reverse engineer and modify American defective tech products, and go into business selling things like kits that install a different app store on your iPhone that doesn't take 30p out of every pound in commissions, and kits that jailbreak your printer so you don't have to pay $10,000 a gallon for ink, and that sort of thing, to a grateful world that would happily purchase those products instead of, you know, consuming the last drops of water in the United Kingdom that are not polluted by human feces to cool a data center to make child pornography. I mean, it just seems like an absolutely bizarre follow-on strategy done by people who have a superstitious dread of being seen as out of touch with the times.
Corey, it is really interesting to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming in. Corey Doctorow.
All right, cheers.
10 to 9. Let's return to the murder of Henry Novak, the 18-year-old white boy from Southampton, which has caused such a huge outcry, especially as that body cam footage was released. And we're going to do this in two parts. We're going to talk about the issue which has so animated and energised the protest that we saw in Southampton overnight, and then also turn to the politics of it with Paul Goodman, a columnist, Conservative peer, former editor of the grassroots website Conservative Home, and also Sundar Katwala, director of British Future, a non-partisan think tank which focuses on questions of identity, immigration and integration. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sundar, can I just start with the philosophical, or if you like, ideological complaint of the protesters last night, which is that Britain lives under two-tier justice and that essentially DEI policies have racialised our public life in a way that's actually discriminated against white people. Is there something to that, Sundar?
Well, it's a terrible and tragic case, what happened to Henry, and his family have called for a full, fearless and transparent investigation. That's going to happen. We've seen that footage, and it's pretty shocking there. The police made a terrible mistake. They've treated the victim as the perpetrator and the perpetrator as the victims. We've got to find out, why was that mistake made? Was it made because it was dark, it was midnight, and they made the mistake, but they didn't believe a young man when he was telling them what had happened to them? What kind of bias, unconscious bias, does that show? So we don't know the answer to the question you ask. I think there's an important point made by the MP for Eltham in the House of Commons, Clive Efford, has been the MP for 30 years, was there when, you know, where Stephen Lawrence was killed and we had the inquiry. There was nothing in that inquiry about that mistake, about the way a black victim or a black family were mishandled, that stop you policing an Asian perpetrator or a black perpetrator as well as a white perpetrator. So it's right to ask all of the questions in good faith, but we don't know the answers yet as to whether it's a terrible mistake or whether it's an imbalance in how the police deal with different incidents of different kinds.
Paul, I want to ask you about the philosophical point, but also about the broader way in which this has played out in British politics, because it's got nasty, hasn't it? If you look at what's happening with Reform and the Conservatives this morning, and indeed Restore, you're seeing Henry Novak's killing and murder being used in the context of the Makerfield by-election.
So I was told that he would come on and have a discussion about Restore, Reform, the right, and that situation, and not about policing in Britain. So sure. I will answer one question about policing in Britain, then I hope we can get on to what I was told by the BBC we would be asked about. What I would simply say is this. The murder, obviously, is completely horrifying for anyone who has been reading about it, and I'd urge anyone to read what the judge said in his summary of this horrifying case, and to listen to what the parents said about how to react. Finally, however, having said all that, I think it's very important we have a long, sober think about policing. I wouldn't want to have to be a police officer. I think it's a really difficult thing to do in the modern day. This is fairly obvious, looking at the whole history of recent events, just putting aside this terrible murder for a moment, that something has gone very wrong with British policing. You've only got to look at what happened in Birmingham in relation to the Aston Villa game to know that. And I think we need to get back to a sort of form of policing that is more colourblind and would deal with some of the anger that is arisen in the wake of this terrible murder.
Okay, Paul, I did ask you about Restore, and I did say, because I read with interest your column in the Times on Monday. I did actually ask you about that. You know, the BBC invited you on to talk about that.
Well, and you did also ask me about that, and I've answered that, so that's
sure.
Fine.
Let's talk about Restore, which is the question I asked you, which is how you think this case could lead to, more broadly, a fracturing on the right, and your concern, as you articulated in that Times column, about whether or not it's actually going to be possible under first past the post to put together governing coalitions when the edges of politics are splintering the way we're seeing.
Let's just remove ourselves from this case for a moment, which you have just mentioned again with respect. I think the situation with Restore is as follows. Conventional politics has not delivered over the last 20 to 25 years lots of growth, control of our borders, good parliamentary government, and it's not really dealt with the problem of Islamist extremism. So you've had reform, and reform have done pretty well lately, and they've got themselves up to 25% in the polls. But here's the thing, 25% is not enough to form a government. So what Nigel Farage has been doing up till now, at any rate, is to reach out to what we call the centre. He's bought in ethnic minority candidates. He's tried to police his candidates for extremism. He's made in his economic policy some concession to financial reality. Now, if you do that, you're going to anger a certain element of your base. So you get Restore. And Restore are currently on about 3% in the polls, and there's a limit to their growth. But the moral of the story is that if, like Reform, you try to move, quote, to the centre, which is what they've been doing up till now at any rate, you're going to cause a further split. And in due course, Restore, if they want to grow, will face the same choice that Nigel Farage has had to face, which is you either move to the mainstream or you remain a tiny body. And this, in our modern fractured politics, looks like happening again and again and again, to the point where we've gone from a three-party system to a five-party system. We could have, what, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different parties in Parliament. If you have that, that does raise the question of whether you can have stable governments at all.
At all, especially under first-past post. Paul Goodman, always good to talk to you, and Sundar Katwala, thank you as well.
4 minutes to nine now.
Well, continuing our theme of non-Nigerian illustrators, which Mike Williams so ably picked up earlier, tomorrow in London there is a very, very special opening. It's the Quentin Blake Centre for Illustration. It's billed as the largest institution of its kind anywhere in the world, a permanent national home for illustration as an art form, I should say, and it celebrates the remarkable Quentin Blake. And someone who's made a career out of wonderful words and illustrations is Lauren Child, illustrator, writer and artist. You may well know, if you have young children, books such as I Am Not Sleepy and I Will Not Go to Bed and I Am Too Absolutely Small for School. And Lauren joins us in the studio now. Lauren, good to see you.
Oh, nice to see you too.
Well, we could talk about your books all day long. We're not going to do that. Maybe we'll do that after we come off air. Quentin Blake, a remarkable figure. And it's nice to see not just Quentin Blake, but the whole idea of illustration getting its due.
Yes, I think it's wonderful. And it's been 25 years in the making and it's celebrating illustration in all its forms. So it's not just storybook illustration.
Do you feel that illustration's been seen as a sort of lesser sibling? It's been sort of given sort of, it's not been given its due as a sort of, or it's not been given equal weighting with words in the way that perhaps it ought to have been?
Yes, I think that's true, because I think it's often seen just as a reaction or an adjunct to the words. But in fact, it's its own thing. And illustrated books are so powerful because you read into the images.
And in a way, you need many words to say something, but you can do that with just one illustration, can't you?
I know. Look at a really good poster or a really good album cover and what that conveys and how you're drawn to it.
Where did you get the inspiration for your illustrations?
I think a lot of it came from indecision. So I work in collage, so everything is cut and cut out with scissors and glued down. And so really it was the feeling that you could move everything around and respond to things in the moment, I think.
It's also very nice that you get a gallery, a centre which is opening, which becomes a kind of hub for community, isn't it? It's nice, the idea of bringing together, I mean, museums do it, galleries do it well, but the idea that a community could come around to celebrate Quentin Blake, but also celebrate wonderful pictures.
That's definitely the big thing with it. It's not just going in and looking at the work. That's important. But you can also come and hang out there and go to the library, enjoy the garden and the cafe. But also there are workshops and things. So you can actually do illustration courses, and they do outreach schemes, and they're very much working with the community. So they have lovely community days where you illustrate.
And a final thought, it must give you such pleasure watching kids go through your books and watching the way they come alive to your words and your pictures.
Well, yeah, that's amazing, because it is a communication. So they communicate back to me how they feel.